Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. You know, the crazy thing about doing radio is that there's always something you forget. You know, I'm here at my desk. I'm like, what did I forget today? I got my water. Okay, that's all set. You know, everything seems to be good. I got my court case. I got everything else. But I'm hearing birdies. Why am I hearing birdies? Well, I left my window open. It was a beautiful night last night. So Jonathan, let's bring Jonathan right on right now because we have a very, very special show for you folks today. And so, Jonathan, if you hear birdies, let me know. Otherwise, I think I'll just leave the window open. But we might get some loud something. When I get a break in the show to play something, I'll do that. First of all, Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on for what could be, you know, 3 hours. You're like our first 3-hour guest. I hope you can stay. And I hope I have enough information to keep it fascinating. But I think we're going to be okay. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. I hope you can hear me because I'm in the middle of a countryside here. And I don't know what part of the house is best. Can you hear me okay?
Actually, it sounds fine. There might be a little difference in our volume strength, so I'm going to try and get back from the microphone a little bit, which will allow people to turn up the volume so they can get going here. I asked, just to let folks know,
I'm also waking up, so that may have something to do with it.
You're waking up.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm awake at 4 o'clock, which is, you know, 5 o'clock your time. You get used to it. You know, you do it long enough, you kind of get used. Well, I don't know if I ever get used to getting up at 4 o'clock. Okay. So just to fill folks in on the context of what we're talking about today, there was an amazing ruling by a judge, Judge Mizell, who I have concluded should have been on the Supreme Court instead of Judge Jackson. Reading this, and I still haven't gotten all the way through it yet, and we're going to do that hopefully today, because this is the most fascinating case I think I've ever read in terms of procedure, in terms of logic, in terms of the way it should be done, in terms of using the statute to define the power of the federal government, to show where the federal government exceeded their authority and literally just made stuff up. This is an incredible case, and this is why I want to do something that I doubt anybody else in the country or the world is doing, which is going over this entire decision on the air for any show. Jonathan, I don't know how much you've had a chance to read this case, but just before we even get started, overall impressions, what do you think?
I would hit on what you said. He's doing it correctly. It's this, you know, it's like C.S. Lewis is famous for his book, Mere Christianity, meaning that Christianity in its normal sense is radical. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just mere law. This is what judges used to do, supposed to do, even when they're tough calls. It's just she's remarkable for just being a judge as opposed to a politician. And so I think it was very, very well done. you know, I think it's a good part of our continuing education of people of things that used to burn my, you know, have smoke coming out of my ears when I was in law school, about the absurd ideas that have taken root in our government and our law and our politics. But it's very good ruling. You call it kind of called for a short answer, so I'll pass it back to you.
Well, you can do long answers today. In fact, I've actually encouraged a few of our folks, for our reporters, to call in. I had another call on the line, and I knew that was going to be delayed getting to it, but we've got one of our regular folks, Pianchi's already on the line. So let's get him here, too. I'm looking for my panel.
We can always count on Pianchi.
Well, yeah, that's why I like having him on the show, and I'm hoping Jim Dykes will call in because we regularly discuss court cases, and he's very good at it as our Second Amendment reporter on Friday. So, you know, hopefully he'll join us too. Pianchi, welcome to the show. Welcome to our very special analysis of Judge Mizell's decision on ending the mask mandates.
Well, it's great to have your great guest. I was just trying to see why come I can't hear you on Blog Talk on the internet. Make sure I can hear you on the phone. So that's great. I'm going to find out what the problem is and I'll get back with you.
Okay, that's fine. As far as I know, we're broadcasting live. I mean, everything appears to be normal at my end. But I have been contacting Blog Talk for months now about getting digital meters.
There it is. Okay, I got it going.
Oh, okay. So maybe it's on
your end. This is a great day in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, yesterday was 420 day, so we talked about marijuana for an entire hour with Chancey Terry, which she probably thanked me for letting her do, which I thought was kind of interesting. All right, let's get going here because we only have 3 hours. I know that sounds, you know, what do you mean, 3 hours for this case? Yeah, trust me. United States District Court, Middle District of Florida, Tampa Division, Health Freedom Defense Fund Incorporated, and that would be Anna Carolina Danza, Daza, D-A-Z-A, and Sarah Pope. The plaintiffs and the defendant, Joseph R. Biden Jr., in his official capacity as President of the United States. I would dispute that right there. As far as I'm concerned, not only is the mask mandate illegal, but so is Joe Biden. So we let me ask Jonathan this. When it turns out that the Trump electors get put forward by the battleground states, and Brandon has deducted the electors he should not have, and he gets below 270, what's going to happen to every action that he's taken? How's that for a big question?
Well, nobody knows. Okay. I mean, nothing like that has ever happened before. I mean, certainly there could be lots of litigation about whether actions are. I mean, I guess there actually is an example, which is the National Labor Relations Board, when the Supreme Court ruled that a member was not properly appointed because the Senate was not in recess, and I think they did try to call into question the decisions that had been made with an invalid member. Frankly, I have to get back to you on that, but I think they were held invalid.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to cover so much ground today that I don't expect you to know the answers. In fact, I don't know the answers. Pianki's not going to, you know, I want to wrestle with the questions because I think that is every bit as valuable over the course of what I want to accomplish today.
Well, let me set this up a bit,
okay.
Even though, like I say, many people may be driving to work or getting a coffee as I am. But it's interesting because this is a new, fairly new judge from 2020.
Mm-hmm.
She clerks for Clarence Thomas.
No, that's
so
a good start.
Be racist, obviously.
Yeah, that's a good start for actually.
No, yeah.
That's good. Yeah. Wonderful.
So, you know, she writes like, confidently, not brashly, but very competently, like someone you'd expect to have been on the bench for a long, long time. But the question here is, and the thing is, it's actually Joseph Biden is the lead defendant, but I would say, because I've wrestled with these issues, like who do you sue? Like with the Obama tried to do an executive order on guns. And, you know, the question was, is that he didn't, you know, and there were other things were, you know, did he do something or did he just, you know, whisper to some agency to do it? And so did you sue the agency, did you sue the president? And here I think it's really more about the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is the main target here. And this comes back to the context where Congress did not pass a law. I mean, this is the bottom line of all of this. Is this whole idea that an executive agency, the Department of, you know, actually what they call one of the fourth branches of government, or fifth, depending on whether you count the media, can make law that Congress didn't pass. So this is the big picture context of this whole thing, is that had Congress passed a law saying that you must wear a mask on trains, planes, buses, And Judge Mizell goes on to, you know, describe the stunning breadth of this. It's the mask mandate is every commercial form of transportation, the terminal, the, you know, bus depot, you know, on the transportation,
Uber.
Include
Uber
in the building,
you know, yeah.
Uber. It's amazingly broad, more than I even realized. So. You know, under normal circumstances, the way our Constitution and politics was set up, you think, well, that's what Congress does. Congress passes laws, right? So this falls under administrative law, meaning that the CDC, in this case, has created a law that Congress didn't pass. And that's what this is all about in terms of the context. And unfortunately, most quote-unquote law regulations in America is under that category. It's for different reasons. It's where the courts, or, you know, Congress passes a law and it leaves giant gaps in the implementation. And the courts say, well, we're presuming that Congress meant for the executive agency to fill in the blanks. So if you read the law that Congress passed, and it's vague and generic and high, you know, 40,000-foot view, that it's implied that the department is supposed to figure out how to actually do it instead of Congress actually writing it into the law. And so they have the implied power to fill in the blanks and to fill in the gaps, as court precedent.
See, I would
said.
Question that.
So
I would question that. See, this is where I think they get into trouble. And they cross that line from using the law to, quote, interpreting. In other words, well, we think Congress put it there, so we're just going to put it there. They can't do that. That's one of my biggest disagreements with the courts, is that they make stuff up. They fill in gaps that they're not supposed to fill in. If Congress left something out, then it's left out. When the founders left out judicial review from Article 3 of the Constitution, that doesn't mean that the Supreme Court can suppose it's there, make up the power, and then use that in every case they please. That's the problem. That's why this case doesn't do that. Well, they come. Well, I want to talk to you about this because we're gonna find out where that line is, or at least I'm gonna try to identify that line.
Well,
between
that's
using
what,
a statute
that's where,
and interpreting. Yeah, go ahead.
That's where it's been, and you know, we've talked about this a bit before, and I think I mentioned it's a huge topic. It's a huge issue of what's really going wrong in our country. But it gets even worse because not only are they filling in, but the courts have interpreted that the department or agency or what have you, the CDC is a agency is actually exercising lawmaking authority, and they're quite clear about that. Is it even though the Constitution gives Congress the sole power of being a legislature, all legislative authority is invested in the Congress. They admit that actually legislating, and they're doing it under a delegation of authority from Congress that's implied. Or
it's not implied. That's the crazy part. It's not implied. It's not even there. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So the thing is that they, you know, and of course, well, people assume in political science that this is done with a wink and a nod because Congress doesn't want to have to take responsibility for some of the hard data, the hard details. So they pass these vague sounding laws, let the bureaucracy figure it out, and then they don't have to actually vote on it. So the thing is that, and when you delegate authority, there are a lot of controversial rules. So there, I mean, all of this thing has happened under, you know, layer upon layer of different rules, like how much, there's something called the non-delegation doctrine, where the Congress can, or anybody can delegate authority, but not too much, you know, not so, you know, the rules that when Congress or someone else delegates authority, it has to have some standards. If they're delegating authority, like, for example, the California legislature did for the governor of California. Larry Klayman and I helped sued because it was just like you can pass whatever laws you want. No standards, no limits, no definition. Just, you know, we're just handing you the California General Assembly and you do whatever. You know, we're just handing it all over to you, to the executive branch. That's supposed to be improper. But in all these things, we've had for more than a century, especially since FDR, that the politicians and the governments have just been stealing third base, or think of a worse of a cliche. So we have all these rules that people have just been ignoring and you know, expanding. And so we've gotten into a lot of the mess we're into because we have rules, we have things to make a limit on these things. but nobody calls balls and strikes. So it's like say people just color outside the lines and then color outside those lines and on and on and on. It just gets insane. So here the questions are, First of all, what's interesting is that Judge Mizell spends about half of the opinion, and it sounds like you have it.
I've read most of it. We're going to go through it. I want to go through it, literally all of it. And so whenever you're ready to begin, okay. We're going to start reading and commenting all the way through.
But let's give the overview.
Let's give the heads up.
The upright T, as I was taught in government, the bottom line, and then the explanation, as opposed to hiding the ball at the end of a long discussion. So
I can read the order. I can read the conclusion if you want. If we can start there and just let people know. Yeah.
Let me explain, because Judge Mizell spends about half the opinion trying to interpret the Public Health Services Act of 1944,
mm-hmm.
PHSA, at 42 U.S.C. 264A, and determines that that on its face, the law does not cover mask mandates, and we'll go into all that. And it's the criticism of this opinion is sort of laughable, because like at the Hill, which I used to go to because they had a comment section, so I'd beat up on liberals, but now they've let me to the comment section. But the now I'm actually spending my time more wisely, but anyway, so they're saying that they're quoting people saying that it's a excessively textualist opinion, and they're saying that her textual analysis of the statute was untethered from the problems of COVID-19. Well, yeah, that's what judges do. Judges go by the law. Dispassionately, you know, they're supposed to be Mr. Spock. They're supposed to go with the law says, go with the legal principles say, and not, you know, put a thumb on the scale. You know, Lady Justice with the blindfold on is not supposed to peek. And so the criticism is that Judge Mizell followed a textual analysis of the law and didn't cheat to get where we want to go in terms of, you know, what they think the needs are for masks. I think I may have mentioned that when we studied these things in law school 100, 200 years ago or more, the most scathing criticism a judge could make of another judge, and when they have a panel, they're often like debating with each other in the same case, is to accuse them of coming up with a results-oriented decision, which in that language, you know, a couple centuries ago was you decide where you want to go, and then you make up an argument to justify it.
Yep.
That was considered to be the ultimate heresy of a judge. Your argument fit your preferred outcome instead of analyzing first and then just, you know, ending up where the law ends up, whether you like it or not. And, of course, today that's, you know, that heresy is normal in the law.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
All right, so it was either Justice Kagan or Sotomayor that complained about the vaccine mandate overturn by saying that, well, COVID's deadly. Hundreds of thousands of people are dying all the time. And she literally made up stuff. And so by her made-up rationalization that the government has to do something, I mean, you know, we've got to, you know, the quote, do something. It's like all the gun control that comes after mass murders. You know, that justifies, you know, in other words, the desire justifies, you know, the end result. And law can't be based on what you want to do. It can't be based on what your political philosophy or ideology demands that you do. It can't be based on what your party wants to do. It has to be based on what the Constitution delegates the authority to do and the laws allow you to do. And so this judge actually is taking the Constitution. Well, she doesn't mention the constitutional law. It's kind of interesting. I mean, I was looking for a search and seizure violations, section of Fourth Amendment, things like that. Yeah, go ahead.
Jonathan.
Jackie.
Uh-huh.
And Green. Why come the states, wouldn't it be better if the states just took back their powers from the federal government? Because it's not doing
Absolutely.
Really good. It's not going right. It's convenient if everything came from one central point. But we have so many varying different items. Let the states take back their own powers.
Yeah, I agree.
No, absolutely. And Judge Mizell uses that as part of her analysis. In what we'll talk about is Chevron deference. And again, if you think you're mad Well, I don't know what you have to do to stay calm in the morning. Drive carefully if people are listening.
This is going
to
be.
But if, you know.
Yeah, this show's going into a press release. We're gonna talk about this. I'm gonna share this with a whole bunch of folks. So yeah, it's gonna be interesting.
Well, if people are mad at the government and upset, they're it's gonna get worse because when you talk about Chevron deference and things like that, deferring to things, but you know, one of her arguments is that states have police power that the federal government doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, political scientists would say that it's convenient for state governments to pass the buck, you know, to duck and just say, well, you know, we're not going to take the hard votes. We're going to give that to, you know, to the federal bureaucracy. Because the whole point of administrative law here, like, again, from a political science analysis, is that nameless, faceless bureaucrats make these decisions and that nobody has any influence over. Nobody voted for them and nobody can vote them out. And those who have to face the voters can hide and say, don't look at me, I didn't do it. And so there's this wink and a nod between the people who who have to run for re-election and give it to the other people. So it's the same with the states. Like, yes, the states should be doing this. And, you know, but by letting the bureaucracies do it, they can evade responsibility. The thing is, of course, the states have complicated, but basically the states have unlimited jurisdiction, and the federal government was set up to have limited jurisdiction. Now, within its power, it is the supreme law of the land, but its scope of power is limited. So we're only supposed to have very limited topics that the federal government is supposed to be legislating on, whereas the states are not that limited. Now, they do have to, they are restrained by the Bill of Rights, but they have unlimited state, what they call police power, whereas the federal government theoretically does not. But again, that's where everybody's ignoring it and just doing whatever the hell they feel like.
That's the problem.
But
yeah.
In theory, yeah, these are things that state government should be doing. And, you know, this is why they're talking about travel and interstate travel, because the hook for federal jurisdiction is often the Interstate Commerce Clause. And that was the thing that was completely bastardized during the FDR administration, the court packing scheme. The worst one is Wicker v. Filburn. The idea that Congress has jurisdiction because it could theoretically affect state commerce.
Well, that's prior restraint. That's a prior restraint thing, and there's a lot of prior restraint in here. We got to do this now because of bad things might happen, and I want to get into that too. So as soon as you're ready, I want to actually get into the language of the case once
we got this all set up. Let me finish my overview because in all of that. There is something called the Administrative Procedures Act, mm-hmm. which is supposed to govern when government agencies issue regulations. And this is the part that where Judge Mizell's decision is likely to stand on appeal.
Okay.
The whole analysis of whether or not the law reaches the topic of masks in the first place, that could go either way on appeal. But the CDC did not go through the notice and comment rulemaking process, and that's considered very serious. And so she strikes that down. This is from Tampa, Florida, so it will go up to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is generally what they call conservative, meaning they actually have a connection to reality. It's not the Ninth Circuit. In California, and you know, so they're likely the 11th Circuit with 7 Republicans to 4 Democrats, which doesn't really mean that much, but you know, it does tend to be more rational based and traditional in terms of the law and conservative. So the 11th Circuit is going to look at this appeal. There'll be a 3-judge panel drawn by lot randomly. But they can ask for a review of the entire en banc, the entire circuit after that. And then, of course, some of it may go up to the Supreme Court. And the Biden administration has announced that they're going to appeal. And they said so basically, as somebody pointed out, rewording what they said, that they're basically doing, they're appealing to preserve their power, the power of the CDC to do this. And now it could be, what may be interesting is if the Biden is phasing this out anyway, somebody's going to raise the question, well, isn't this moot? And it may be, because if the Biden administration is saying, we're appealing to preserve the CDC's power, but we're going to end the mask mandate anyway, somebody could say, well, wait a minute, this is all a waste of time. So
well, the CDC doesn't have that power, though. That's part of the question for me. The CDC doesn't have the powers that they're saying the Biden insurrection is saying that they have. That's one of the big problems with the CDC. I want to define their powers, too. I still haven't found exactly what their powers are, but I know a lot of things what they can't do, a lot of which are defined in this case.
But the thing is, the CDC said they did not go through the rulemaking process under the Administrative Procedures Act.
Yep.
They invoke
an
exception. She says the exception doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. And everything she said is extremely well documented with precedents. You know, that's one of the reasons it's so long, because every point is like documented by multiple precedents. And she said that they didn't go through the APA. And remember, I've talked in the past about how the liberals use the Administrative Procedure Act to clobber anything that Republicans try to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Republican
DACA
lawyers
is the biggest example, I think, right?
Yeah, right. And right, you know, because they did not to do DACA for, you know, de facto amnesty for children, you know, children up to 32 years old who came here illegally. They did not follow the Administrative Procedures Act to create it. But then they say Trump didn't use the Administrative Procedures Act to end it, even though it was never validly created in the first place. So Republican lawyers are typically weenies, cowards, you know, dumb and fat and lazy. And the left uses these tools to run circles around them. So this is an example where somebody is actually using the tools that the left relies on. And, you know, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And they're all, you know, they're all screaming about it. This is a Kessel analysis. So the part of this that is almost certain to survive on appeal is the Administrative Procedures Act, is that the attempt to make an exception saying we don't need to go through it doesn't apply. And they try to say it's not a regulation. It's not a rule, and of course, if it affects people on a broad scale and mm-hmm. even criminalizes behavior, then of course it's a new regulation. And so that's where my overview takes us in terms of – what was the other thing? There are a couple.
Well, see, I think you prepared this whole thing, and I didn't know you actually had an overview prepared. So this is we don't talk a lot before we do things on the show here. So it gets kind of interesting. So I'll make sure that I think I misunderstood.
Well,
so
again,
I'll make sure that's complete, and then because I'm just ready to go on this case. It's really kind of funny. Anyway, so
the thing is, I say, these for me these are issues that go back to the 90s when I was reading these things in law school, and you know, with smoke coming out of my ears. Reading some of this stuff. So there's that. And I've done similar things with Larry Clements. So anyway, that's the overview, is that does the statute broad enough to include requiring people to wear masks? And that's a very complicated analysis that takes like half of the 57-page mm-hmm. opinion. And but the part that's likely to stand on appeal is the Administrative Procedures Act. So that's the overview.
Thank you.
It sounds to me like the Administrative Procedures Act is overstepping its bounds constitutionally. You're giving to an agency powers that agency was never supposed to be delegated with. A bill mm-hmm. becomes an act. An act becomes a statute. Then that statute is applied to a particular agency, like the Department of Health. Well, the individuals that run the Department of Health is supposed to interpret that statute, then make rules and regulations. But if those rules and regulations are giving them powers that they were not supposed to have, then everything needs to go in the trash.
Yes, absolutely. And we've tolerated this nonsense for, you know, since at least since FDR.
Well, time to change that. And here's what's interesting, too. And when all else fails, the criticism of the judge is that she was a Trump appointee. So this shows that Trump has some really decent people in our judiciary. All right, let's get to the order here, which says this is the very first section. I'm going to go through the sections. We're going to go through the individual ones. Jonathan, great overview. Thank you. Like I say, I think I didn't mean to interrupt or step on that too much. I didn't realize you had such a comprehensive overview planned. All right, so the order. Let's begin the case. It says, as travelers have been reminded for more than a year, federal law requires wearing a mask in airports, train stations, and other transportation hubs, as well as on airplanes, buses, trains, and most other public conveyances in the United States. Failure to comply may result in civil and criminal penalties, when you talk about that too, including removal from the conveyance. This masking requirement, commonly known as the mask mandate, is a Center for Disease Control and Prevention, that would be CDC, regulation published in the Federal Register on February 3rd, 2021. I want to stop right there, and Jonathan, if you can explain what exactly that means to publish something in the Federal Register and how that has the effect of law.
When an agency issues a regulation, they do it primarily by publishing it in the Federal Register, which is an actual, you know, sort of in-house magazine of the federal government. It's like a permanent record. It is a government publication. Normally, they're supposed to start with an NPRM, Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, and they're supposed to propose the rule, show what the process is for commenting, where can you send your comments, and then listen to receive comments from the public. Here, they just go through that process.
Hold on, Pianki.
You're absolutely right, Jonathan. The Federal Registry is supposed to give the public the opportunity to make comment on what's going to be proposed upon them. And it's not happening when it's supposed to. If you ever have an opportunity to read the Federal Registry, you can see that's what its intent was.
Yeah, it's pretty hard reading. But you're right.
That's why we're laughing.
But people should try it. But of course, everybody who's interested, all the lobbyists and trade associations, they read it. You know, every day it comes out and they read it.
They're paid to read it.
Affecting them.
They're high paid lobbyists. They're paid.
Well, they are.
Yeah.
And the and then when the final comes out, they might after a lot of comments, they might have an amended proposed rule. But when the final rule comes out, it's published again in the Federal Register, which again, even though the authority comes, as we talked about, publishing it in the Federal Register is the last step of actually getting it, you know, actually officially making it. It's like serving some of the lawsuit. Like if it's published in the Federal Register, then it's real.
Yeah, but here's the point of why I want this explanation, which thank you, is that Congress has enacted at this point. You can publish something in the Federal Register. We're not talking about the Congressional Record here. This is two totally different things. And just the act of publishing something in the Federal Register, if I understand it, Congress has to object or positively say that they don't want the regulation published in the Federal Register. Otherwise, it becomes a regulation, which has the effect of law. Whereas what it should be is nothing should become a regulation or law published in the Federal Register unless Congress takes it up and passes a bill, thus doing it legislatively. But do I have this correct, that if it's in the Register and Congress doesn't object to it after 90 days or whatever it is, it actually becomes a regulation without ever having even been considered by Congress? Is that correct?
That would be a good improvement.
But actually, it's backwards. That's backwards, Jonathan, because at a municipal level, a bill, a new ordinance has to be read three times. It can be read the first time in its entirety, the second and third time by title only, and the citizens have a right to oppose it or approve it. And that's not being happened at the federal level. They have run amok.
Well, this never went to Congress. Right. This mask mandate never went to Congress. There never was – the regulation was published. There was no public comment, as we're going to talk about later. And they just enforced it. So they made up their regulation, they published it, and then they started enforcing it with no constitutional or statutory authority, no constitutional authority from the Constitution, no statutory authority from Congress. They just did it. That alone, to me, would have made it illegal.
Of course, they did it, 13 days after – well, 13 days after he who shall not be named, took the oath of office.
Yep, February 3rd.
On January 20th, which means they had to be working on it for months but in order to get, to publish it on February 13th, 2021.
Yeah.
And so they published this rule after basically COVID-19 was basically winding down. And so go ahead.
Well, I've got evidence that it actually ended back in July of 2020, but we'll talk about that later. So we're talking February 3rd, 2021, okay, which is, just under a month under January 6th, 2021, and just a couple of weeks after January 20th. All right, so here are our plaintiffs. It says, in July 2021, Sarah Pope, Anna Daza or Daza, and Health Freedom Defense Fund, and I post that thing on my Facebook page. Anybody wants to look it up, you look up Health Freedom, and then you look up the Health Freedom Defense Fund, and you'll find exactly who these people are. They're wonderful. Anyway, Health Freedom Defense Fund, this is why I think this was planned for months too, sued various government officials and the CDC seeking a declaratory judgment. Of course, this is why I have Jonathan on the show to explain these terms, seeking a declaratory judgment that the mask mandate was unlawful and to have it set aside for violating the Administrative Procedures Act, which we start talking about, known as the APA. Following submission of the administrative record, defendants, collectively referred to as the government, moved for summary judgment on January 18, 2022. As provided in the parties' agreed briefing schedule, plaintiffs filed a cross motion for summary judgment February 17th. The parties completed briefing March 31st. The cross motions for summary judgment are now ripe for review, which is why this decision's here. The court concludes that the mask mandate exceeds the CDC's statutory authority and violates the procedures required for agency rulemaking under the Administrative Procedures Act, which is just what Jonathan talked about in his overview. Accordingly, the court vacates the mandate and remands it to the CDC. Wow. Can you explain declaratory judgments, summary judgments, cross motions? What the hell just went on there? this is fascinating.
Declaratory judgment is a special proceeding that allows the interpretation of a law, a statute, a constitutional provision, even a contract sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like instead of waiting until you've actually been injured, you can ask for the court to interpret it. You have to show that you're likely to be injured, that it's not just a theoretical game. But, a common use of that would mean that there's a new law and I intend to do what the law apparently doesn't allow me to do, but before I go ahead and do it and get in trouble, I want to know if this law is valid or what does it actually mean. So what they're saying is that I intend to, and some of the plaintiffs of course talked about they had exceptions, health exceptions, and other things that weren't recognized. The mandate did recognize some exceptions, but they were too narrow and too vague. And so some of the plaintiffs said that, because of this, I am going to get on a plane without wearing a mask because of this, and therefore I'm challenging, before I get arrested and thrown off or fined, I want to get the court to decide that I am not facing any legal liability if I do that. And,
as opposed to civil disobedience, where they just did it and then took the consequences later. So it's like the opposite of civil disobedience, right?
Well, it is. And it's a special statute. It's like an exception to the normal. I mean, normally the law would wait until someone is actually charged with it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a statute and a rule in federal courts, as in, I think, probably all states, that allows the courts normally are somewhat stingy about allowing a declaratory judgment because they don't want just a bunch of theoretical things.
You're fading in a little bit in your line here. So I don't know where you start off. Great,
I think that's,
you,
I think that's the wind.
The wind. Okay, that's fine. All right.
Civil disobedience.
I mean,
civil disobedience is a form of free speech. It's what it is. It has different forms. The first is, the ultimate is out in the street protesting, throwing rocks. The first one is, you know, petitioning your officials. When that don't work, then
right,
they step it up.
Right. An example might be if you say you're not allowed to question an election decision, and you go to court.
Interesting example,
and
Jonathan.
Say, yeah. And you go to court and you'd say, because we have Marjorie Greene on tomorrow is going to testify about whether or not she can be removed from the ballot because she questioned the election results. So
wow. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
So for example, if you say, you know, I intend to publish this article proving that the election was flawed or whatever you want to say, but before I do it, I want a decision that I'm allowed to do that, notwithstanding this law. And that would be enough to get a decision on the question, you know, before you actually publish it. Because you say, if I do this, I'm facing, you know, a criminal penalty. So I want the court to decide ahead of time. Now, a summary judgment is where there's no need for a trial. Usually it means because it's a decision purely on the law. They're saying the law, you know, we don't need to get into the facts or disputes of facts.
Mm-hmm.
Just the law itself is enough to decide the case. All we need is an interpretation of the law. And so both sides here said that the law says we win under, you know, under our interpretation. This is what the law says, and we win, and we don't need to go any further. Summary judgment requires that there's no material facts in dispute. There are usually facts in dispute, but they're not material to the outcome. It's like the court says, well, you might have a lot of disputes about what happened or facts, but it doesn't matter. The other side wins anyway, based on just the pure reading of the law itself.
Yeah.
Maybe as narrowed, sometimes it means that they take discovery and they narrow the facts, and then they could say, well, I can decide, you know, without going through the rest of the case, without going to trial, the judge can decide right off the bat just because of what the law says. That's what happened here.
Okay. Now, there's no question
of
standing.
Yes, like
arbitration. Let me quickly just jump in, Priyanki. Standing. This is usually the way that the courts dismiss things, like the election lawsuit of Texas against the other states. They say, well, you don't have standing. So standing is canceled by a declaratory judgment and then a summary judgment. They don't even consider it. Do they assume standing, or it's just not considered in the case?
No, they have to allege it. And that's where these people have to allege that. That, you know, the way this regulation is written, even though I have a valid medical excuse, they would not recognize my particular kind of medical excuse, and therefore I am affected by this. I cannot get on a plane. I cannot travel because I am personally affected by it.
Okay.
And so declaratory judgment, that they do have to prove that they would actually be, it would actually affect them.
Okay.
It can't be just a theoretical discussion.
Summary judgment is like arbitration, where you have an arbitrator listening to two sides. Even though it is dismissed for standing, you still have the other side that's still going to stick to their guns, like Marjorie Greene. She should not be penalized or punished because she is expressing her free speech, which is basically the will of the people that back her. That's totally wrong.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah,
absolutely. The background.
We can get into that whole topic today. I think we might want to.
we've got one paragraph.
Yeah,
we have 57
is,
pages more to go. It's going to be an interesting morning. I'm sorry. Go ahead. We're not going to consider everything in this kind of detail, but yeah.
We can
ahead,
read
Jonathan.
The law itself, if you, unless you wanted to go ahead.
I want to do the cases. So we're going to get into the law. I actually have the public health law. I've got that section 42. I've got the Cornell Law Dictionary. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into all kinds of stuff. But I want to do that when it comes up in the case. So the first section is background.
Okay.
And here's where I challenge some of it. It says, in December 2019, a highly contagious respiratory virus, colloquially known as COVID-19, began spreading throughout the world. A month later, the Secretary of Health and Human Services declared COVID-19 a public health emergency. And it says, see determination that a public health emergency exists. Okay, I would challenge that too, but that's another story. And then it says, and then on March 13th, 2020, which is 2 days before the 15 days to slow the spread, if you guys remember, all right, President Trump declared the COVID-19 outbreak a national emergency. And then it says, skip, citations. I'm going to skip a lot of citations here. COVID-19 continued to spread throughout 2020, despite experiments with, quote, unprecedented movement restrictions and social distancing measures. By the end of 2020, approximately 20 million Americans had been infected with COVID-19, and over 360,000 Americans had died from it. Okay, now we know the CDC fudged the numbers. I'm not going to get into that now, but there's a lot of challenges we can make there. But I want to stick, you know, primarily with the case. Then it says the fall and winter of 2020 also brought a spike in new COVID-19 infections due in part to emerging variants of the virus, some of which were more severe than the original strain and more easily transmissible. We can challenge that too. But anyway, it says the number of new cases peaked in early January 2021 and decreased steadily in February. And then it says on January 21, 2021, which is one day after Brandon was installed in the White House, this is funny. It says here, one day after taking the oath of office, President Biden issued Executive Order 13998, see promoting COVID-19 safety in domestic and international travel, Federal Register. There it is. Okay. The executive order recognized the threats of the continuing COVID-19 pandemic and reasoned that mask wearing, quote, can mitigate the risk of travelers spreading COVID-19. And we know the masks don't work. I don't want to talk about that either. But I want to stick with the case because the case itself is what I find so fascinating today. Then it says the order directed executive officials to require masks on various forms of transportation and while in transit hubs. How are we doing so far? You guys all following along? Like I said, there's a lot of what I think was misinformation in that background. But
it is misinformation.
Yeah.
See, the argument with this COVID stuff, Greg, is whether the mask works. That should not be the argument. The argument should go back whether you have the authority to do what you're doing. You can tell people can say, I'm going to put Kleenex, put cotton balls in my nose. That could be what they're trying to make you do.
Yeah.
It's not whether it works or not. It's whether do you have the authority to deny U.S. citizens of their liberty for the way that you're going about doing it.
Yep. That's actually a really good point I want to address too, because if the masks actually did work, that's not a justification for the law any more than if the masks don't work is not a justification for getting rid of it. You know, so can you explain that a little bit? Because I think Kennedy's really onto something.
No, he's absolutely right. Those are different issues. And of course, this opinion really didn't get into whether the masks work. They should. It's like, and it's part of the reason is because, like, that's what summary judgment is. Because you're saying,
okay,
assuming that the CDC were right on the facts, they still lose anyway. Is the way the summary judgment works. So, but yeah, you could say, well, you should have leeches. You should have bloodletting, or people should be required to wear a necklace of garlic herbs. What is it, the word garlic? I forget what they're called.
Vampires or what?
You know. Yeah, I mean, correct, vampires and COVID-19, you know, so who knows?
Oh, I see.
But do they have the authority to require you to wear, you know, a garlic necklace? There's a word for those things. What do they call those? Do they have any authority to do that?
Superstitions, preventives, I don't know.
Masks are a superstition because of the size of the holes in the masks.
Yeah, that's true.
But the thing is it they didn't have, she didn't have to get that far. Now, if it went to trial, and you know, then they might get into that and say, you know, we dispute that the masks are even a rational. There's even what, and this is a legal term, that there's even a rational basis for requiring masks. But she didn't have to get that far because she's talking about what the statute requires itself.
Yeah.
And let me, can I take over for the next paragraph? Because I want to emphasize.
Oh, yeah. So
something.
You're right there on the case with me? If anybody was, I've
on page
before,
four.
Okay, so go for it. Go for it.
It says approximately 2 weeks later, on February 3rd, 2021, the CDC published the mask mandate without allowing public participation through the APA's notice and comment procedures. See requirement for persons to wear masks while on conveyance and transportation hubs. Again, 86 Federal Register 8025. You know, it's published in the Federal Register. As the basis for dispensing with the ordinary APA requirements, the CDC found, you know, we have an agency issue a finding about itself, that, quote, it would be impractical and contrary to public health to delay the mandate to seek public comment. It at 8030. I hope you can hear me. I'm outside.
Yeah, well, it's still a little bit wind noise, but, yeah, I can always read it over if you think there's any.
All right. Talking louder here. The mandate also disavowed being a rule under the APA. Now, notice that, so it's impractical for them to go through the public comment, but this is a year after COVID-19. So they're saying, well, Biden became president, and so suddenly it's a rush. It's impractical for us to go through the APA rulemaking process. But it's a year later, like a year and 1 month after COVID. So I don't think she makes that point, but
yeah, no, she doesn't.
So, but here you've got, so like,
go ahead.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
We're still,
no, I mean,
it's such a
rush. We waited a whole year, and now suddenly we can't wait to do it properly.
Well, I focus on the fact that they consider it impracticable is not their call. You know, you have a rulemaking procedure. You have to go through it. We have to have public comment. So what they're really saying is we don't give a damn what the public says. We have a rulemaking procedure. We're not going to follow it. We're just going to impose this. So it's not a rule at that point. That's why they call it a mandate and not a rule, because it never became a rule, because it never followed the procedure to become a rule or regulation. It actually was a literal mandate, a decree, you know, from on high, with none of the procedures that would be justified in having it actually be either a law from Congress or a rule by regulation. It was just a mandate imposed because they wanted to. How am I doing?
Right. And then
you
the last thing was
thanks, Pierre.
<Yeah. laughs> And then the last
right.
thing is they
well,
say
did.
That it's not a rule within the APA. It's like they didn't have to follow the rulemaking procedure because it's not a rule. Well, something that applies broadly to the general public and restricts them on a widespread basis, you know, it's clear, you know, and allows people, you know, for example, if somebody said, well, our employees can take lunch from 12:30 to 1:30. See, that's not a rule because it's an internal procedure. But something that affects the general public widely and broadly and dictates what they can and cannot do, well, that's a rule. That's a regulation. It's a law.
Yeah.
They tried to tell the public that they weren't even passing a rule because just because they said so.
Yeah. Let's continue on here. Bianca, do you have a quick point? I want to get back to the case.
Well, but here's the point. Given all that, the states had the power to tell the federal government to go to hell. Federal government has no policing powers. They could have stopped that. States could have stopped that in its tracks and said, we are not going to do it.
Well, some
because
states did.
What
Florida.
Governs the state?
Florida stopped a lot of the mandate.
It's the Bill of Rights that governs the states. The people's power over the states is the Bill of Rights. And they could have said, hell no, we're not going to do it. Just like they're bringing in these illegals into states at night and all this crazy mess, states could tell that they could stop that immediately.
Yes, they could. I found the pathway was civil asset forfeiture, but I want to save that for another show. Let me get back to the case here. It says, in the mandate, the CDC explained that COVID-19, quote, spreads very easily and sustainably between people who are in close contact. It says this spread occurs mainly through the transfer of, quote, respiratory droplets from one person to another. They don't even consider aerosols, you know, which go through the mask. This is why they don't work. Anyway, then it says this spread occurs. All right, I read that. Okay, it says masks, the CDC found, prevent this spread by blocking exhaled virus and reducing inhalation of these droplets. It says because COVID-19 can be spread by pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic individuals infected with it, the CDC found that masks are, quote, one of the most effective strategies available for reducing COVID-19 transmission. Okay. None of that is true. I find this fascinating.
It's right. It's not true.
None of it's true.
The virus can go through your damn eyes.
Yeah, the 6 foot or 3 foot distance that the UN and the WHO recommend, you know, it comes, you know, do nothing. It comes through your eyes. The idea that pre-symptomatic people are, if you're pre-symptomatic, you don't have it. If you're asymptomatic, you don't have it. That was proven over and over again through all the doctors that have, you know, Zelenko and all the other folks that we've had on the show, plus all the other doctors out there. Asymptomatic people are not transferring it, because if you're asymptomatic, you're not sneezing and coughing droplets that have COVID. Okay, so none of this is true. Does that have an impact, Jonathan, or is that just
too,
background? Go ahead, Bianchi. And then watch Jonathan's opinion.
And then, too, like down in Florida, the one doctor that's the head of Florida Health, what he said about masks.
Labadeau.
Well, he's representing, yeah. He's representing the state. His judgment should be above the CDC, because we're talking about the power of the state, and yeah, people are being bamboozled and not using it.
Yeah, Jonathan, do you have a comment before I go? Well, I press on.
And it's Judge Mizell is sort of arguing that even if, you know, she is making, saying what are they claiming, giving the context, and sort of the function here is that even if all this were true, they still don't have the power to do it. It's the way the whole thing fits together.
Mm-hmm. Pressing on, the mandate did not differentiate between the kinds of masks. Or on their efficacy at blocking transmission. It simply included a footnote linking to the CDC guidance for the attributes of acceptable masks. Masks can either manufactured or homemade and should be a solid piece of material without slits, exhalation valves, or punctures. In other words, they didn't care whether you slapped an old handkerchief over your face or some guy that wore his underwear over his nose or any of the other things people were doing. So in other words, it wasn't the quality of the mask that was important to the CDC. It was the fact that they controlled you and made you put something over your face. That seems to be the basis of their law. Jonathan?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, that's a pretty damning. I don't think she expands on it, but it's a pretty damning.
But we did. We're going to, yeah, because there are gaps in this decision. As good as it is, as much as I love this decision, I find gaps. That's one of the biggest gaps right there, is the fact that the quality of the mask didn't matter to the CDC. It's just the fact that they could make you do something, which puts it in the brand of control as opposed to public health, as far as I'm concerned. Bianchi, do you want a quick comment? Then I'm going to proceed more.
You're absolutely right. You can have underwear over your face. Even dirtier underwear will protect you more than clean underwear. But as Jonathan said, they don't have the authority to make you.
Yep. Pressing on, the mask mandate requires that a person must wear a mask while boarding, disembarking, and traveling on any conveyance into or within the United States. The mandate's reach extends to aircraft, trains, road vehicles, including ride-sharing services like Uber, vessels, this is where the cruise ships get involved, right, and other means of transport. It also applies beyond conveyances to any transportation hub, which includes any airport, bus terminal, marina, seaport or other port, subway station, terminal, train station, U.S. port of entry, or any other location that provides transportation subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. That's a pretty big amount of stuff, right? It says, in addition to the requirement that individuals in these locations wear masks, the mandate also enlists conveyance operators to police it. It requires operators to use, quote, best efforts to enforce masking. And this is where we get into the whole idea of state actors that Jonathan told us about before. Jonathan?
And also, he just told you that the federal government has no ability to police that, so they're delegating or sneakily throwing it onto those local and state agencies.
Yeah, like deputized Karens, but that's another story. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
Oh, my
Jonathan,
God.
State actors.
What way to put it? No, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, because that is amazingly one of those radical parts of this is, mm-hmm. is that, like you say, they're deputizing Barney Fife, the Karen, to enforce the fact that doesn't jump out at people is kind of frightening. That that basically they're, and people have complained about that with businesses, people going into businesses at state level, is that, you know, it isn't just that you're requiring people coming into my business to, you know, to wear a mask. You're making me a police officer that I have to enforce it. And that's perhaps the most radical thing of all, it seems to me.
Yeah. It says, continuing on, I'm going to get through until we get to the legal section. I'm going to take a quick break for a few minutes, give you all a chance to refill your coffee cups, and we'll continue on. You folks, of course, listening to this, hope you keep listening, but I played some of these before. In fact, today I'll have Santa Rosa Volunteers piece on Federalist 11. That'll be presented tomorrow. All right. The judgment, the opinion says here, though broad in scope, the mandate provides exceptions to limits its coverage based on the person, conveyance, or situation. First, the mandate excludes children under the age of 2 years old and persons with a disability that prevents them from being able to safely wear a mask. That's one of our plaintiffs is claiming. Right? The latter exception applies only to individuals who cannot wear a mask because of a disability that is within the scope of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Well, that's interesting. Second, it excludes non-commercial use of vehicles and commercial vehicles occupied by a single person. So if you're a truck driver driving alone, you don't have to wear a mask. Fascinating. Third, it excludes situations where, for example, a person must wear an oxygen mask or is actively, quote, eating, drinking, or taking medication. And of course, we've seen those examples on airplanes. People will eat a bag of nuts for like an hour. Or must remove the mask to verify his identity or to catch his breath after, quote, feeling winded or to communicate with someone who is hearing impaired. So the exceptions, Jonathan, do you have comments on that?
Again, those are issues that this judge did not need to get into to reach the result. But ultimately, those would punch holes in the, what they call the rational basis of,
what's that?
Of the law. It would indicate that the law is not rationally related to its purpose. And if we get into fundamental rights, like the right to personal liberty of your body, then it would have to have a higher standard that those exceptions don't, show the weaknesses in the logic of the law.
Yeah. See, I don't see a compelling state interest argument against a Fourth Amendment, warrantless search and seizure, because a mask actually is a seizure. It's a seizure of your person, preventing you from doing things unless you comply. And I don't think she talks about, she talks about that a little bit, but she doesn't talk about it in terms of Fourth Amendment search and seizure, which I found surprising.
Well, I mean, the thing is if it were, if her analysis here were overturned, then it would move on to those arguments.
Okay. So you don't have to include everything in the summary judgment. Okay. No, that's just good to know.
The thing is there is sort of a legal principle that if a case can be decided without getting into a constitutional argument, you decide it on the lesser ground first. And I think that people might find that weird. But the idea is that big constitutional issues should only come for decision when they're clearly framed, when they're carefully presented and fully briefed and everything like that. So I think it's a cop-out, but that's the argument, is that by the time you get to a big constitutional issue, you should have tried everything else first, is the way the law, the courts look at it.
Okay.
So those issues could come up if the appeal court were to overturn this decision.
Interesting. Back to the case. Health Freedom Defense Fund, Anna Daza, and Sarah Pope, those are the plaintiffs, sued to challenge the mask mandate on July 12, 2021. Daza and Pope routinely travel by airplane. Daza has anxiety that is aggravated by wearing masks. Daza alleges that the government does not recognize her anxiety as a basis for medical exemption from the mandate. Similarly, Pope flew regularly before the pandemic, but has done so less since the CDC, I guess that's a chilling effect, imposed the mask mandate as the constricted breathing from wearing a mask provokes or exacerbates her panic attacks. Health Freedom Defense Fund is a nonprofit organization that opposes laws and regulations that force individuals to submit to the administration of medical products, procedures, and devices against their will. And that comes right out of the Nuremberg Code. Health Freedom represents the interests of its members who are subject to the mask mandate, at least one of whom has alleged harm sufficient to establish standing in her own right. There's standing again, okay? Explaining that an organization may sue on behalf of its members if at least one member has standing. The government does not dispute that at least some plaintiffs have Article 3 standing to challenge the CDC's transportation mask order because it imposes a legal obligation on the individual plaintiffs to wear masks when using public transportation. Let me go back to the earlier part of this paragraph that says that they don't recognize, you know, in other words, the CDC is picking and choosing which medical exemptions they recognize and which ones they don't. And do they have that authority?
You know what this reminds me of? You got a judge. No one can tell me that all judges don't know what the hell is going on. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of you got a judge sitting there on the bench, and he watched the plaintiffs and defendants walk in, and he or she is saying to themselves, let's see where this is going to go. Where do they want it to go? Because that's basically what you're saying. These arguments are fruitless. They just going around in circles like a dog chasing its tail. The size of it's the mass, it's the disease, and all. It's just fruitless.
Well, I don't agree completely. I don't think it's fruitless. I think what's fascinating, though, is that the government is picking and choosing what they consider a medical excuse, just like the companies. You know, we have companies picking and choosing which religious exemptions, you know, are allowed, you know, so you don't have to get the jab. And what they're doing is they're saying that they're making you justify your religion. So they're actually controlling person's personal religious beliefs, which is against the First Amendment. Yet that's what they're doing, because you have to have not only a religious belief but a sincere religious belief. Well, who determines the sincerity of your belief? The corporation that's giving you the jab? You know, and this is why I say, does the government? This is my question for Jonathan. Does the government have the right to be that subjective, where they say that medical exemptions exist, but we're going to tell you exactly which medical exemptions exist? That's my question.
Well, this stuff has got completely out of control, Greg. It's completely out of control. If I can say it in a calm voice.
Yeah, but this is bringing it back in control.
Somebody thought of it. It's a ball of confusion. It's all a ball of confusion.
Yep. Jonathan? Is he there?
Yeah.
There you go. Welcome back.
that undermines the, the deference and the rationality of what the CDC did. Here it didn't affect her outcome, but it does weaken the rationality of what they did. It is a problem in the Biden administration is that they really did do a careful job. We'll get into Chevron deference, which will make people mad.
We're up to part two, the legal standards. So I'm going to get to that once we take a bit of a break here. Your line is it kind of fades in and out. It's really frustrating because I want to make sure we get every word you say because we're making a record here again.
I don't know why that is, but the thing is that like I say, the fact that can you hear me now?
Yes.
The fact that they clearly did not do a good job of fashioning the rule under, you know, weakens the CDC's position.
Well, they didn't feel they had to. They said that, you know, we don't have to get public comment. We don't have to have this challenged by anybody. We don't have to do any of the normal procedures. We're just going to impose it. All right. The last part here is interesting, too, and then we'll get to the part two legal standard. It's the seeking a declaratory judgment that the mask mandate is unlawful and to have it set aside under the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act. Plaintiffs sued President Joe Biden, a term I never use unless it's actually officially in something, President Joe Biden, Secretary of Health and Human Services Xavier Becerra, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky, and Director of the CDC's Division of Global Migration and Quarantine, Marchen Citron. This jumped out at me like nothing I've ever seen. Well, it just jumped out at me. CDC's Division of Global Migration and Quarantine? Jonathan, what the hell is that? Where did that come from?
That's new to me. I mean, except the only thing I'll comment, if you can hear me, is that there was this false story that Trump got rid of the global pandemic unit or whatever. There was a bloated National Security Council in the White House. If somebody's supposed to be watching global pandemics, it should be at the CDC, not in the National Security Council in the White House. But, you know, supposedly somebody's watching these things, but I guess they're not doing a very good job. I've never heard of them before, and I wrote a booklet on COVID, And I don't know, you know, I've never heard of them before.
Well, you know, it seems to me global migration is the opening of our southern border. I think we have global migration right now. And the CDC is getting rid of the part of Title 42 that would prevent it on public health grounds. So this could, you know, Martin Citron, whoever you are, A, you're not doing your job. B, you're working for an illegal administration. And C, I've never heard of this global migration and quarantine. That's because they're actually getting rid of the quarantine part. They're just going for the global migration. That's fascinating to me.
Right. Yep.
Go ahead. Okay. All right. I'm going to take a break for a few minutes here for us here. Like I said, I'm going to mute you guys, let you go make some noise. And I'm going to play something. Let me see what I can play here. It's not too long. Let's do Church and State. I haven't played that one for a while. So it's about 7 minutes. So we're going to take a break here. Probably the last one we're going to take. Maybe we'll do something in another hour. We're 10 minutes into our second hour. We have this hour plus the next hour to go through this case, which I find fascinating. Hopefully we'll get through. We'll go faster as this goes. But let me play something for now and be right back in a little bit. And here we go. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. There is no separation of church and state in the Constitution. Therefore, the Supreme Court can't imagine that it really is there or should be there, so they can't create the rule out of thin air and then enforce it as if it actually did exist. The biggest problem with the controversy between Thomas Jefferson, then president, and the Danbury, Connecticut Baptists, a religious minority, is that everyone focuses on the answer by Thomas Jefferson saying there is a wall of separation between church and state. But they never consider the request made by the Danbury Baptist that Jefferson sought to answer, and therefore where the wall of separation actually is. If you only have the answer, then you can make the question anything you want, including making the question fit the answer to advance an agenda, or denying that there even is a question. The question now is whether the government is free from any of the moral constraints or persuasiveness of religion, such that religion and government are walled off in isolation from each other, so that government can contemplate and implement any power for themselves without any organized religious participation, debate, opinion, objection, or protest. That is a complete bastardization of the exchange between Jefferson and the Baptists, and it has been used to advance a bogus set of laws and court opinions. The background for this controversy comes from the article mentioned below, which says, "The First Amendment was meant as a limit on the National Congress only. Madison wanted limits on the states too, but they were rejected. State limitations on religious liberty and establishment persisted after the First Amendment was adopted. Religious tests for office remained in place in most states, and Connecticut, 1818, and Massachusetts, in 1833, did not disestablish their official state churches until decades later. The Supreme Court reinforced the idea that the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states, but rather only to the national government in Barron v. Baltimore in 1833. Back to me. Where this becomes especially critical is when the states, not the state, as in government in general, but the individual states, establish their own religion and churches because they were not subject yet to the First Amendment. It is in that context that Jefferson is responding to the Danbury Baptists. The key part of the Danbury Baptist letter to Jefferson is this clause. What religious privileges we enjoy as a minor part of the state, we enjoy as favors granted and not as inalienable rights. And these favors we receive at the expense of such degrading acknowledgments as are inconsistent with the rights of free men. The Danbury Baptists, being a religious minority in a larger group of Congregationalists, which was the state religion of Connecticut, were being discriminated against for not being part of the state religion. And because the First Amendment only referred to Congress making no law regarding the establishment of a government religion, but left the states free to do so, we had religious freedom at the federal level, but privilege and discrimination at the state level. That is why the Danbury Baptists wrote Jefferson. Now Jefferson's response makes sense. He says to the Baptists, "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." Put in modern English, the individual relationship between man and God is direct, and the wall of separation is so that the government never crosses that wall between individuals, their churches, and God, with state religions, state churches, religious laws and tests, religious qualifications for office, etc., etc. However, there is nothing in law or the Constitution preventing churches, religions, and religious individuals like pastors, priests, ministers, etc., and just regular folks too, from exercising moral persuasion, evaluation, and criticism over government, because the free exercise of religion also includes the redress of government for grievances. The wall of separation of which Jefferson spoke only works one way. To understand Jefferson and the Baptists, it's not the wall of separation between church and state, it's the wall of separation between the free exercise of religion and any state established religion. That's it. Everything else is agenda-driven narrative. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This episode also used Thomas Jefferson's misunderstood letter to the Danbury Baptists from the Washington, Jefferson, and Madison Institute website. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. And we are back. I have Jonathan and Bianchi live on the show. And again, other callers, like I say, it's just I want to make sure we get this get through as much of this as we can. And then we'll have other times for more general discussions, but I really want to focus now with a couple of folks. And again, I've asked some reporters to call in as well from this show. All right, so we're back. Jonathan, Bianchi, let's continue on with Legal Standard, part two of this multi-part decision. So summary judgment is appropriate if there is no genuine dispute as or to any material facts, and the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And that comes from case here. It says a fact is material if it could change the outcome of the litigation. And they got Anderson versus Liberty Lobby. It says, and a dispute is genuine if a reasonable finder of fact could conclude for the non-moving party. What's the non-moving party? I think you covered this under summary judgment, but non-moving party. What parties are moving? Which parties are not?
Well, the moving.
What's that mean?
The party filing the motion, asking for summary judgment, is the moving party or movant.
Oh, okay.
And the non-moving party is the one opposing it.
Okay, so the plaintiffs would be moving, and the defendants, the government, would be the non-moving party.
Yeah. They're the opponents of the motion for summary judgment.
Okay. Back to the case. This is the APA requires that reviewing courts, quote, hold unlawful and set aside agency action that is arbitrary or capricious or in excess of statutory jurisdiction, authority, or limitations, or short of statutory right, or that was issued without observance of procedure required by law. That's pretty much what you said in your whole overview, right?
There are several bases for it, and she hit several of them.
Ah.
There are possibly more, but She kind of hit all of, you know, most of the grounds for being assigned.
Okay. So the Administrative Procedures Act, arbitrary and capricious, let's define those terms real quickly, because I see those all over the place.
Well, I mean, there are several reasons. One being arbitrary and capricious is that it's unrelated, you know, factually unrelated to the law, to the purposes. You know, like she could have gotten into the fact that there's, you know, if there was no, like, for example, if you said that you have to wear garlic buds around your neck, if there's no basis for it, it would be arbitrary and capricious. In this case, the fact that government agency does not take public comments and then ignores significant public comments. If somebody raises significant issues, the agency must consider them and respond to them. And if they don't, that would be arbitrary and capricious because they're not considering all the factors. If on its face without public comment, they did something without, because again, the government agencies, you know, are established by the fiction that they're experts. The reason why we have these government bureaucrats and nameless faceless people is that they're supposed to have an expertise in their field. And so if they just like, you know, we read this in the Washington Post, so we're going to do it without any basis, then it would be arbitrary and capricious, and it would be invalid for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah, I think of arbitrary as they just made it up, and capricious means it's frivolous. I mean, that's how I look at it. Let's go on to analysis part three. Yeah, who wants to comment? I heard someone in there. I'm still getting a little wind noise, Jonathan, so it's just, you know, we're trying to get the best audio quality, too, for this. Shall we proceed? Anybody have a comment real quick? Oh, okay. Analysis, part three. Plaintiff's amended complaint challenges the CDC's mask mandate on several grounds. It alleges that the mandate exceeds the CDC's statutory authority. That's count one. And we're going to take each count individually here. In the alternative, it alleges that if the mandate is statutorily authorized, Congress improperly delegated its legislative power to the CDC. That's count four. The amended complaint further alleges that the CDC improperly invoked the good cause exception to avoid the notice and comment procedures required under the APA, count two. Finally, it alleges that the mandate violates the APA because it is arbitrary and capricious, and that's count three. Jonathan, do you want to take those individually, or you think we've covered those?
Well, I did cover them. Why don't we go ahead, if you're going to go through the order, we'll get to them when they come up. But that, that's a good overview.
Okay. There's two other counts, count five and six, that challenge the lawfulness of Biden's January executive order, but they withdrew these claims in their motion for summary judgment. With that withdrawal, Biden is due to be terminated as a defendant to this action. Well, that might be interesting, too. All right. Is that a strategy thing to do that, to drop two counts to get him out of it? Does that make it easier?
That's something legally was taken by the CDC. Biden incited them to do it, to use the term of the day, but the actual action, you know, it'd be like saying, like, you should shoot that person, but the person who actually pulled the trigger is responsible. So, Biden's executive order didn't actually affect anybody. It just told the CDC to do this, but it was the CDC who did it. So that would be the reasoning there.
Let's get to the actual claims. It says, this is A, the mask mandate exceeds the CDC's authority under the Public Health Services Act. And then we're going to get into this Public Health Services Act is rather interesting. So it's different from the Administrative Procedures Act. So if you're trying to follow the legislation, these terms are new to you. I wanted to make that distinction really clear. The judge says, because administrative agencies are creatures of statute, they possess only the authority that Congress has provided. We've got National Federation of Independent Businesses, other folks. Anyway, it's a case. In issuing the mask mandate that requires most persons to wear masks over the mouth and nose when traveling on any conveyance into or within the United States, then we have another thing here. The director of the CDC relied on a section of the Public Health Services Act of 1944. Okay, we're not talking about new law here. And we were still in World War II at that point, okay? So this would have been about, you know, somewhere around the D-Day invasion this thing got passed, which I find fascinating. Anyway, it's abbreviated PHSA, Public Health Services Act, C 42 USC Section 264A. Now, this is Title 42. that jumped out at me too. So the part when the news folks are saying that the branded insurrection is going to dump Title 42, they're not. They're only dumping a particular part of it because Title 42 covers the entire public health, stuff. I wish they would dump it because nothing in the Constitution gives Congress the authority to make laws or the executive to make regulations of public health. That's a state power, which is what Pianki was talking about earlier. But this is what they're basing this on. These folks really go back and reach back. A Public Health Services Act of 1944. Which is section 264A, and I've got all four sections of it from the Cornell Law School Institute of Legal Stuff, and I'll read that in a minute. It says, excuse me, declaring regulatory authority under statute to the CDC. All right, that's what 264A does. That provision empowers him to, and that would be we'll find out who that is in a second. I guess it's the head of the CDC, to promulgate regulations aimed at, quote, identifying, isolating, and destroying diseases. And the citation is Alabama Association of Realtors versus Department of Health. So let's get back to Jonathan. Do you have a quick description of the Public Health Services Act of 1944? And then we'll get into what it specifically says. Now, I know you mentioned it earlier.
Well, a couple thoughts. One is that I think you said, I'm not sure what you said, but
I goofed
it's
on
delegating
that. That was
regulatory authority. So it's granting authority. And again, delegating regulatory authority means the Congress is giving an executive agency the power to make law, which is their job. But
right.
And I want to clarify before you talked about the Public Health Services Act and the Administrative Procedures Act. The Administrative Procedures Act is a general set of rules that apply to all agencies and how they behave in making regulations, whereas the Public Health Services Act is specific to what was the old HEW, Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and the CDC and regular, relevant health-related agencies. So it's specific to that. And they're claiming that it allowed them to – and I think in this quote here, maybe you have it, it says, the bracket CDC. I'm suspecting that the name has changed since 1944 is why they're saying – is that way?
Well, I'll tell you what I think. I think they said that because the CDC is not mentioned in Title 42, Section 264A. That's why I think they did that. I think it's a transfer of authority. The key part here is that
I didn't notice that.
Oh, yeah, well, that's why I'm going to read you the actual statute. This was the CDC bracket.
Okay.
I'm going to read you that's not – let me give you the actual act from Title 42.
Well, let me say one other thing first.
Go ahead. No, please do.
One thing that's interesting here is that this whole analysis by Judge Mizell is strengthened by two previous decisions by the Supreme Court. The CDC overstepped its authority with regard to the cruise ship industry.
Yep.
And, oh, goodness, what was the other one? So she's quoting from the Supreme Court
evictions.
Case.
Evictions, real rental
yeah, evictions.
Evictions.
And, so her decision and everything we're talking about is based significantly on two Supreme Court decisions already construing this law against the CDC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everyone admits that those were more out to lunch uses of the law. This one is a closer call, but she's got two Supreme Court opinions that she's quoting for and saying this stuff that she's quoting from Alabama Association of Realtors versus Department of Health and Human Services by the Supreme Court. So, and this is it was what they call a per curiam opinion from the Supreme Court, which means everybody agreed. When they say a per curiam, it was like it's a consensus of the Supreme Court. So anyway, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, and this gets fascinating, especially this part here. It says administrative agencies are creatures of statute. They possess only the authority that Congress has provided. And that to me is a very significant part of this also. So here's what is in the court case. It says the brackets, as Jonathan said, CDC with the approval of Secretary of Health and Human Services. Let me tell you what the actual statute says. This is another of these things that kind of jumped out at me as I was reading this. So let's go to the Cornell Law School Legal Information Institute. My favorite source for statutory code stuff, 42 U.S. Code Section 254, Regulations to Control Communicable Diseases. The part in question is Section A, which says promulgation and enforcement by Surgeon General. Okay, the Surgeon General is not part of the CDC. The Surgeon General is a totally separate office. The Surgeon General right now is a man. That's not germane to the conversation either. I just want to throw it in because I can. All right. Section A, promulgation and enforcement by the Surgeon General. The Surgeon General, with the approval of the Secretary, assuming, you know, Health and Human Services, is authorized to make and enforce such regulations as his judgment, as in his judgment, are necessary to prevent the introduction, transmission, or spread of communicable diseases from foreign countries into the states or possessions, or, and this is a big or, from one state or possession into any other state or possession. For purposes of carrying out and enforcing such regulations, the Surgeon General may provide for such, and here we go, these are really key words here, for such inspection, fumigation, disinfection, sanitation, that's going to come up again, pest extermination, destruction of animals or articles found to be so infected or contaminated as to be sources of dangerous infection to human beings, and other measures as, in his judgment, may be necessary. Jonathan. I know you're there.
I was muted.
Unmute. Yeah, I need you.
This is the relevant – no, I muted myself. This is the relevant part of the statute, and this is where she spends half of the 50 – what is it, seven-page opinion talking about what does the statute mean. Mm-hmm. And this is – you know, I think she comes to a correct decision, but this is the part that most likely will be a battle royale in the appeals court. But but this is where Judge Mizell argues that – the ordering people to wear masks is outside the authority granted to the Surgeon General, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the story is on that. And their interpretation that this allows them to do absolutely anything, and she argues, as we'll see, is that the consequence of that would be stunningly broad. And she gets into a lot of analysis, which we'll talk about, like if Congress intends to do something that sweeping, the rule is supposed to be that they have to be clear, not like this. So this is the key part of the statute that she then spends, you know, other than the Administrative Procedures Act, which I say is a slam dunk in Judge Mizell's favor against the mask mandate, this is where the majority of the discussion is on this statute, and it's becomes very interesting. Does the CDC ever have the authority in the first place?
Yeah, yeah, and this is why I wanted to spend the time on this case. So that, you know, for those of us that are bill nerds and law nerds, you know, the really and legal nerds, and really get into this stuff. If you understand this, if you take the time to understand what's happening here, not only do you understand the mask mandate, but you understand so much more about how government works, how it doesn't work, the authority they do have, the authority they don't have, the things they can and can't do, and this transfers to so many other areas of law, you know, and even to the election itself. Whether there are, in fact, should legally be there, and what can be done about it. A lot of this is found within this one case. This is like a goldmine of legal knowledge. Let me press on. Other sections of the PHSA, the Public Health Services Act of 1944, folks, also provide the CDC with a limited power to apprehend, detain, examine, or provide conditions for the release of individuals, quote, coming into a state or possession from a foreign country. That's our border. And this is probably the part that they're getting rid of when they get rid of some of Title 42, all right? Then it says, or traveling between states, but only when the CDC, quote, this is the key part, reasonably believes that a person is, quote, infected with a communicable disease and is, here's another quote, a probable source of infection to others, okay? In that latter situation, the CDC may detain the individual if upon examination he is found to be infected. So in other words, I see this. The CDC has no jurisdiction until they prove somebody is actually infected. They can't quarantine the healthy. Jonathan.
You know where that idea came from.
Pianki
Ellis.
Yeah.
Ow.
Okay. But those are foreigners.
Yeah,
those are supposed to be
Ellis
Island.
Ask Jonathan.
Yeah, well, it was a quarantine station.
They used to quarantine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. They used to quarantine the immigrants that was coming in.
Yeah, that's why they were on an island. They were on an island, so it wouldn't transfer to the United States. Angel Island on the West Coast for Asian immigrants did exactly the same thing. It was part of my tour as a San Francisco tour guide. It's not exactly, I think, what's important, but it is the fact that the government is, and this is before the CDC, I think, was even created, that Ellis Island was a place where foreign immigrants would come to the United States, but they were not lawfully admitted to the United States until they proved they were healthy. And what's happening here is the reverse of that. they're actually assuming everybody is sick. Well, actually, it was maybe it's the same thing. But the thing is that the federal government does not have this general ability to assume that everybody is guilty of having a disease. And I use this, you know, in terms of legal terms, guilty as opposed to healthy. You can't quarantine the healthy. We've been saying that for 2 years. And yet that's exactly what the CDC did with masks. Assume that everybody's healthy. And to prove you're able to travel, you have to wear a mask. Jonathan.
Well, Florida done it. When travelers was coming into Florida.
That's not Jonathan, by the way.
If they didn't look right, they had in a hotel for 14 days, right?
Well, yeah, that's the cruise ships. We're getting into that, too. That's part of this thing. But Jonathan, the idea that the CDC, you know, can just detain everybody until they prove that they're okay because they're wearing a mask. That's not part of the statute at all. That's the major argument, right?
Right. Quarantine, you know, it's always been understood to mean a restriction upon someone's freedom of movement because they actually have a disease or they've actually been exposed to it. You know, Virginia statute, you know, all the various state statutes like that did not give even the state governors, again, the legislature is supposed to pass these things. The state statutes did not give the power to restrict the movement of the healthy. It's only for the for those who actually have it, and that's what. Now the other thing is in terms of Ellis Island and stuff. Remember that the U.S. government has no obligation to let someone into our country from outside.
Yep, that's
so
true.
So it's a little bit different because, you know, if somebody says, you know, I want to come in and says, no, we don't, you know, they can allow people, they can keep people out on grounds that they could not restrict someone who's either a citizen or a resident.
Mm-hmm.
So they can say, well, we're not going to let you in until we wait 2 weeks to see if you're healthy because they don't have to let you in at all.
Exactly. And states don't. Then when you get in within 20 feet of the shore, if states don't want you to come in, you can't come in. But another thing, a local health official has more power than the mayor of the country. Let me give you an example. If you have individuals showing up at a clinic with VD, venereal disease, and in their survey asking who their partner is, where if there's an abnormal number of cases that's associated with a particular name, they can go out into the city and grab that person and put them under quarantine.
Yeah, I think that happened with some AIDS folks that were purposely, you know, spreading it as far as and why, because they were, you know, they had some mental issues and deranged, and that was a big issue too. But yeah, Jonathan, if you want to comment on that, then I have another point to raise on this whole idea of quarantining the healthy. I think I saw how they got around that. Jonathan?
No, go ahead.
All right. So part of the reason I think that the main reason that the fact that, you know, the Brandon insurrection came up with this idea of asymptomatic transfer or that goes back to Trump. You know, way back in the beginning, they kept talking about everybody has to wear a mask because you might kill grandma. You know, this idea of asymptomatic transfer or pre-infection, a transfer, I think was used to make everybody guilty of having this disease. And I don't say infected or sick. I say guilty because it really seems more of a legal proceeding than it does an actual health proceeding. And so by creating asymptomatic transfer, which the World Health Organization said doesn't happen except in extremely rare cases, and the idea of a pre-infection, assuming everybody's infected with this and can give it to everybody else, that gets around this idea that you have to prove that somebody actually is sick before they quarantine them. They're literally quarantining the entire nation because they assume that everybody has it, and you can't prove you don't have it because people without symptoms have it too. That's where I think that all came from. Jonathan?
You can't win for losing, right? There's no way to.
You're guilty. And the way you prove you're innocent is you comply with these regulations and mandates, even though the mandates themselves do things they can't do. All right, let's press on. Since Congress enacted it in 1944, the Public Health Services Act has generally been limited to questioning or quarantining, infected individuals and prohibiting the import or sale of animals known to transmit disease. And that's Alabama Association of Realtors again. It has been rarely invoked, you know, at least until recently, within the past 2 years. The CDC has found within their 264A, which we read, the power to shut down the cruise ship industry, stop landlords from evicting tenants who have not paid their rent, and require that persons using public conveyances wear masks. Courts have concluded, this is what Jonathan talked about earlier, courts have concluded that the first two of these measures exceed the CDC's statutory authority under Section 264. Reasoning that the CDC's conditional no court has yet ruled on the legality of the third, and of course that's the mask mandate. At first blush, it appears more closely related to the powers granted in Section 264A than either the sale order, I'm not sure what that is, or eviction, the cruise ship sale order, that's what the sale order is, okay, S-A-I-L, or the eviction moratorium. But after rigorous statutory analysis, the court concludes that Section 264A does not authorize the CDC to issue the mask mandate. That's the real key to this. Section 264A does not authorize the CDC to issue the mask mandate. Jonathan, again, I read that really confusingly, but I don't speak legalese all the time.
Like I say, I'm pummeling, like they say in the movie industry, if you're going to have the Jaws theme music, eventually you have to show the giant shark the Chevron deference that
we'll
you know we're get the monster is finally gonna pop out of the shadows here. Where they're saying here is like, well, we should give deference to the agency's interpretation of 264A and under this doctrine of Chevron. But here she's saying, well, wait a minute, since 1944, if we're supposed to give deference to the CDC on their interpretation, how come for the last 77 years, whatever it is, they never came up with this interpretation before? It really undercuts their argument that, oh, yeah, this always meant that. Well, yeah, really? So how come all this time it never meant this?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, no, this is fascinating to me. But the whole idea, let me just skip back just a little bit here. When they talk about quarantining individuals and animals and they actually were dealing with the folks that actually had a disease, whether they be animals, people, or stuff or things. And then we'll get into this too. This is going to get more interesting, folks. You know, stand by. Keep hanging with us because we're about to get into another fascinating area. So the court concluded that Section 264A of the Public Health Services Act does not allow the CDC to issue mask mandates, nor does it allow them to shut down the cruise industry, nor does it allow them to block evictions, for lack of payment. They can't do any of those things. In fact, the first two were already done. The third one, the mask mandate, is now done. Okay. Court goes on, as always, when determining the meaning of a statutory provision, the court looks first, there's another fascinating area, looks first to its language, given the words used their ordinary meaning, and that's Artis v. District of Columbia. It says the opening sentence of Section 264A grants the CDC power to issue regulations that in its judgment are necessary to prevent the spread of communicable disease. The second sentence informs the grant of authority by illustrating the kinds of measures that could be necessary: inspection, fumigation, disinfection, sanitation, pest extermination, and destruction of contaminated animals and articles. More legal citations. Thus, if Section 264A authorizes the mask mandate, the power to do so must be found in one of the actions enumerated in the second sentence. Okay, more citations. That sentence provides for, as we said, inspection, fumigation, disinfection, sanitation, pest extermination, destruction, and other measures. A requirement that individual travelers wear masks is not, underline me, not, inspection, fumigation, disinfection, destruction, or pest extermination, and the government does not contend otherwise. Instead, it argues that the mask mandate is a sanitation measure or an other measure akin to sanitation. Jonathan.
This is where Judge Mizell gets into a very academic and technically correct analysis of the statute that may be attacked on appeal because the courts of appeals are so used to stealing third base and playing, you know, they have inconsistent rules as to how they interpret statutes. But I think hers is technically correct, but she's being very careful. And it's interesting, I will get into why she interprets it this way. You know, there's these rules. For example, I think you skipped over the part where it says, in other words, the second sentence narrows the scope of the first.
Oh, did I miss that?
That's a technically correct but controversial idea, that you say that, you know, when there's a general statement followed by examples, the examples limit the meaning of the first of the general statement. And those kinds of rules of interpretation are very important, and the devil's in the details. But unfortunately, the courts pretty much pick and choose whether to ignore the rules at, you know, at their desire. They, you know, they basically sort of keep two sets of books depending on which way they want to turn out. They have rules that say one thing, and then they have the rules that say something else, and then they do whatever they want to do. I hope you can still hear me, right?
No, you can still hear you, but let me clear that up, because I actually said that, but it's not as clearly stated as Jonathan just did. It says the opening sentence of 264 grants the CDC power to issue regulations that in its judgment are necessary to prevent the spread of a communicable disease. That's the opening sentence. The second sentence informs the grant of authority by illustrating the kinds of measures that could be necessary. Okay, so in other words, the first sentence tells what it can do. The second sentence lists certain things. And what the judge is going to go on to do is say that if it's not in those certain things or related to those certain things, it's not included in the definition. And that's what the judge is basing this on. And yeah, I think that could definitely be challenged on appeal, but I think she's absolutely right. And here's what I want to use to illustrate that. Our bill to change Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, because it says here, and here's a list of things, and then we'll talk about what Big Tech is doing. So Section 230A says any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider, that's your social media providers, okay, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all right, the provider or user considers to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or, and here are the catchwords, otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. So there's your list. Just as they had fumigated, inspected, sanitized, and things like that in Title 42, Section 264, this is going to get real nerdy for folks who aren't used to this, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, what Big Tech uses to censor, ban, fact check, shadow ban, restrict, you know, accounts and all the other things that they do to destroy your ability to get on social media is exactly the same thing the CDC is doing, you know, with their mask mandate. Okay, well, we got the power to do this because, you know, and here they're using that same list. You know, the CDC is using sanitation for a mask mandate. Big Tech uses obscene, lewd, lascivious to shadow ban, you know, fact check and everything else. It's exactly the same principle. This is why this case is so important. Jonathan?
And like I said, these are standard rules of interpretation. It's too bad that courts don't know them. This is black letter law. They said how do we interpret statutes except when we don't want to? That's the way it works in the real world. It's like here are the rules, but you know we ignore them when we don't like the result. But this is, I mean, these are non-controversial. They're non-controversial ways of reading statutes and other things, except that they're just completely ignored when it suits someone's purpose.
Yep. So let's go back a little bit here. It says a requirement that individual travelers wear a mask is not inspection, fumigation, disinfection, destruction, or pest extermination, and the government does not contend otherwise. Instead, it argues that the mask mandate is a sanitation measure or an other measure akin to sanitation. Okay, and then we got Tiger Lily. This is explaining that the residual clause, the second one, other measure, encompasses measures that are similar to inspections, fumigation, destruction of animals, and the like. Okay, so this is technical, but I think it's very important that when they have these general terms at the end, you know, the Section 230, things that Big Tech finds otherwise objectionable, things that are not necessarily sanitation, fumigation, inspection, et cetera, or residual clause, other measure encompasses measures that are similar. Okay, this is how Congress, you know, sort of tries to encompass everything they haven't thought to list? and regulatory agencies take that and run with it to include anything they want. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, it's an example of laziness by the Congress or a state legislature that they don't stop and think about it. They just say, or whatever else.
Okay.
But a couple principles is that, again, rules of interpretation, you know, ignored when we don't feel like it,
right,
is the idea that the legislature is presumed to know what the law says. So when we're trying to interpret what Congress said or what a legislature said, the courts assume that the legislatures know what they're talking about and that they're familiar with the general principles of law, and even that they're familiar with specific precedents on, you know, on the topic. And, you know, and it's a pretend, because even if there's no evidence that the Congress or the legislature actually thought about it or they actually knew about it, the only way to rationally interpret the statutes is to pretend that they did know. So there is this rule, and I don't know how to pronounce it. It's noci fiutor, which is what you said. If there's a list and then a general term at the end, the general term at the end has to be interpreted consistent with the specific list.
Yep. That's really important.
Whenever you say, right, and that is a again, non-controversial standard rule in the law that, you know, if someone is guilty, what was the example I was going to give a while ago? If someone, someone will get a extra points for applying to a Congress if they have run a scholastic award, you know, perfect grades, you know, scholarly competition or other competition. That doesn't mean it can be a hot dog eating contest. The fact that the context is all scholastic means you can't win a competition on blowing bubbles in a bubble gum contest and count for the thing. It has to be consistent with the specific examples and read that way.
Yeah.
And not only is that the law, but Congress or a legislature is presumed to know that when they're writing. So if they write something with this open-ended thing, they should be presumed that they intended it that way, even if there's no evidence they actually did. We have this presumption that they intended for the open-ended term to be consistent with the specific terms.
Which makes sense, but I wish they'd say so. You know, but I guess they did that in law. But again, law gets messy. So let's just to sum up where we are right now. The government, the Brandon insurrection, said that the mask mandate comes under sanitation or other measures. The plaintiffs disagree, arguing that a mask requirement is outside the scope of sanitation. And here's where it gets even more fun. The PHSA, the Public Health Services Act, does not define sanitation. If a term goes undefined in the statute, this is where I need Jonathan again, if it's undefined in the statute, courts give the term its ordinary meaning. Taniguchi v. Kanpak Saipan Limited, okay? Courts often start, this is the part that absolutely floored me too, courts often start with dictionaries. Wow, I didn't know that. Is this what you guys do? Courts often start with dictionaries. Given that the statute was enacted in 1944, the court looks to dictionaries from the early and mid-20th century to begin its analysis. Now, here's what immediately struck me. The Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia. In order to understand a well-regulated militia, you've got to get your dictionary from 1776, which will say that a well-regulated militia is a group of citizen soldiers who are equipped like the infantry, like an army infantry. They're regular equipment. Their cap, their ball, their musket, you know, their powder, you know, their flint, whatever was and that's why the soldiers were called regulars. We don't call soldiers regulars anymore. We call them infantry. But if you want to understand the Second Amendment, as this judge just described, go to the dictionaries of the time. A well-regulated militia is a well-equipped citizen army, like an army with the same equipment.
Yes, and we do actually look at dictionaries. They're real, especially in states like Virginia.
Yeah.
That's because the statute doesn't define the term. If the statute, excuse me, just a second. If the statute says that an apple is a banana, then you go by what the statute says. But because the statute is silent in interpreting it, then you have to go to the dictionary. And again, it's sort of presumed that when the writers of the law wrote it, that they wrote it against the backdrop of the common ordinary meaning in their day. Is that what, that's what they, you know, for example, if they wrote in, if they wrote in 1920, mm-hmm. that we're going to honor gay music. They would talk about the Roaring Twenties when they had, you know, the flappers and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't mean what a use of the word 100 years later, you know, 100 years after they wrote the statute. So it would have to be what did they mean at the time, in the common ordinary meaning. But if the statute defines it, then the statutory definition controls.
Makes sense. Yeah, the gay '90s was not a great time for homosexuals. You know, 1890s. That's not what the gay '90s refers to. It was a really happy time for this country, like the Roaring Twenties. Pianki, we haven't heard from you for a bit. Do you want to get into this before I continue? Because this is where it gets really into the weeds, but I think it's fascinating.
I'm holding on to my seat.
This is why you're on the panel. All right. The Public Health Services Act does not define sanitation. If a term goes undefined in a statute, okay, I read that. Courts often start with dictionaries. Given that the statute was enacted in 1944, the court looks to dictionaries from the early mid-20s. I read that too. All right, here we go. They provide two senses of sanitation that are relevant here. First, sanitation may refer to measures that clean something or that remove filth, such as trash collection, washing with soap, incineration, or plumbing. See Webster's New International Dictionary. This is kind of fun. Defining sanitation to include rendering sanitary. Then we got Funk and Wagnalls, New Standard Dictionary, 1946. Defining sanitation as the removal or neutralization of elements injurious to health. Second, sanitation may, and here's where it gets confusing, right? But she at least recognizes the extra definitions here. It says, second, sanitation may refer to measures that keep something clean. And then we have Funk and Wagnalls, which says the devising and applying of measures for preserving and promoting public health. And that comes also from Bernard Molloy, the Simplified Medical Dictionary for Lawyers. I'm sorry, I cracked up at that point. Have you ever read the Simplified Medical Dictionary for Lawyers?
No.
Anyway.
I didn't know there was one.
Apparently there is. It was written in 1951. It says the use of sanitary measures to preserve health. All right. Examples of this sense of sanitation include air filters or barriers, masks, gowns, or other personal protective equipment. So she's actually given the other point of view. She says that, okay, one, sanitation usually means, you know, removal or neutralization of things, injurious to health. The second sense of it from the simple medical dictionary for lawyers says that it can be prevention. In other words, air filters, barriers, masks, gowns, or other personal protective equipment. So she's actually giving the other side argument to the claim. And why would she do that?
Well, a judge is supposed to do is to show that she considered everything and that she's analyzed the different arguments. I mean, that's the way non-cause-oriented judges are supposed to do things. That used to be normal.
Okay. So you give one side, you give the other side, and then you pick one of them, I guess is what's customary, because that's exactly what she does here. Okay. All right, it says, put simply, sanitation as used in the Public Health Services Act could have referred to active measures to cleanse something or to preserve the cleanliness of something. So there's a difference between actively cleaning and preserving cleanliness, and I think that's the real distinction we're talking about here. Then she says, while the latter definition would appear to cover the mask mandate, the former definition would preclude it. Let me say that again. The latter definition of preserving cleanliness would appear to cover the mask mandate, but the former definition of actively cleaning something precludes it. That's really the key to the whole sanitation argument.
It is, but that's where an appeal court, not as rigorous in following all the little rules that she's following, you know, could easily overturn it. Is like, you know, they could easily wiggle out of this whole part of the argument on those grounds. But I think she is following the correct analysis, Judge Mozilla.
Yeah, because the appeals court could then say, no, the second part dominates, not the first. And that's when it goes to the Supreme Court. Anyway, it says, accordingly, the court must determine which of the two senses is the best reading of the statute. And we got Calderon versus what? We got some other things here. It says, explain that one word may take multiple meanings and that choosing between definitions depends on context. And we got Catalyst Pharmaceutical against Becerra. And then it says, selecting from among definitions based on statutory context. And then she says, to aid in the statutory interpretation inquiry, dictionaries provide only a helpful starting point. Explain that dictionary definitions will often fail to dictate what meaning a word must bear in a particular context. And I think this is where the judges come in, right? They give a broad sweep of what a word might mean, but not what it must mean in each context. So this is getting, again, into the weeds here a little bit. So let me say, and then she goes, a bunch of stuff I'm going to kind of skip over here. But then we get to the next section. It says, based on these methods, which she goes into in excruciating detail, the court concludes that the first sense, that of active cleaning, is the meaning of sanitation in Title 42, Section 264A. And that's overruling the CDC, which says, no, it means prevention. You know, it means the second sense. That's really her conclusion right there in terms of sanitation, in terms of the CDC's authority, right? It does not appear in Section 264. They do not have the authority because the first sense, the active cleaning, is what sanitation really means, not what the CDC is now saying that it means. Have I got that right?
Right. Yes. And that's where that's the current – shoot, I'm trying to take it off speaker so you can hear me. But that's that is it. And that's where it becomes the most controversial. But she, jumping, you know, stealing your thunder a little bit, she also goes on to say that sanitation has the meaning of cleansing a place, not a person. So she, you know, I'm skipping ahead of what you're probably going to read, she strengthens her argument by saying that sanitation does not mean cleansing a person. It means cleansing an object.
Yeah, well, let's get into it.
So,
yep.
All right.
It says right here, sanitation is limited to cleaning measures. Statutory construction is a search for the ordinary contemporary meaning of terms in their context. When called so let's talk about it. It says Section 264 indicates that sanitation and, quote, other measures, so she's taking both terms into account, refers to measures that clean something, not ones that keep something clean, which is exactly what Jonathan just said. Wearing a mask cleans nothing. This is the judge talking, right? At most, it traps virus droplets, but it neither sanitizes the person wearing the mask nor sanitizes the conveyance. Because the CDC required mask wearing as a measure to keep something clean, explaining that it limits the spread of COVID-19 through prevention, but never contending that it actively destroys or removes it, the mask mandate falls outside Section 264A. Masks help prevent people who have COVID-19 from spreading the virus to others. So there you go. It's outside the scope. Seems pretty clear to me. Jonathan's muted again. Let me go on.
Yeah.
Did you have a comment on that part?
That's the main issue on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And this is, the government would read sanitation and other measures more broadly. The government defines sanitation as the promotion of hygiene and the prevention of disease by maintenance of sanitary conditions. Thus, they are using it in the second sense, that of a preventive measure. Of course, a word may or may not extend to the outer limits of its definitional possibilities. Whether it does depends upon reading the whole statutory text. In the same way, words that can have more than one meaning are given context by their surroundings, and that's Whitman versus American Trucking. Thus, even if the government is correct that sanitation may extend to preventive maintenance measures, and even if masking is a, quote, conventional sanitation measure, there are four reasons to believe it does not extend so far here. And those are the four claims we talked about earlier. I think it's the top of the hour. I'm going to take another break here for a couple minutes and decide where we want to go with this. I might skip over some of the stuff here because now the sanitation discussion is long, tedious, I think necessary to prevent appeals, but it's not something we may necessarily want to contend with here. Jonathan, what do you think so far? We're going to take a break for a bit here.
No, I agree. That's basically, again, this is not all of her basis for overturning it, but this is where this one topic of, does the statute ever go this far in the first place? Mm-hmm. This is what it turns on. And it's a really, it is a very good education in how these things go. And again, remember, this is all in the context of Congress could have just passed the damn law. You know, they had a year in which to, if they wanted to pass a law the normal way, they could have done it, but they didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. We got more stuff here. Just to read this quickly here, it says the history of Section 264 is another clue. As the list of actions suggests, the federal government's use of the quarantine power has been traditionally limited to localized disease elimination measures applied to individuals and objects suspected of carrying disease. Yeah, let me, I'm going to do a quick little thing here. Oh, here we go. This is a section that is really important. I want to get done with sanitation before we take a break. This is part two. Sanitation is limited to property, which is something you talked about a minute ago. There is another serious flaw to the masking as sanitation argument. Subsection A of 264 does not give the CDC power to act on individuals directly. That's really important. CDC does not have the power to act on individuals directly. Reading the statute as a whole shows that it is divided into two parts. Okay. Anyway, but the main part is, the CDC, this is the first part, gives the CDC power to directly impose on an individual's property interest. The second part gives the CDC power to directly impose on an individual's liberty interest. And you know, we got more cases, more things. Let me take a break right now. Jonathan, do you have a comment before I play a couple things here real fast? And then we'll get back to our discussion here. Nope. Okay. Let me play some stuff. Mute yourselves if you want. I'll be right back in about 3 minutes and we'll continue on with this. In the meantime, Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.
Action Radio. Part of the ADHD Radio Network. The ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio.
I want to start up with something before I get to another key section of this court case. When we talk about words and multiple meanings and in the context of their meaning, one of the things that we did with our Australian Bill of Individual Rights is that we took out the word unreasonable searches and seizures and put in the word warrantless. And the reason we did that is because an unreasonable search, according to the original meaning, was a search without a reason. It wasn't that it was unreasonable in terms of judgment or common sense. It was unreasonable because it didn't have a reason. And the reason and how you prove that the search does have a reason is you get a warrant. So we changed the word to mean warrantless. In the same way in the Declaration of Independence, it says we are endowed, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Well, we include the same thing, but we took out the word certain because certain can mean, you know, it's absolute. It's certain that you have unalienable rights. It could also mean that you only have certain unalienable rights. So language is really key to all this. This is why I focus on it so strongly. And you may think I'm off the deep end, but words like certain and unreasonable taken out of context will bring about a completely different interpretation. Let's get back to Jonathan Pianchi. What do you think? You guys are both live.
I'll say that, yeah, I agree. And I forget whether it was Judge Richard Leon, I think it was, or Judge Lambreth with Larry Klayman opposing, you know, warrantless search of telephone communications and emails and things like that, where he won an injunction against the NSA. And one of them said that they have gotten a call, that, you know, they even had people catch up with them, like the FBI or marshals, while he was riding on a Sunday afternoon on the back of his motorcycle to sign a warrant. And so he had no sympathy for the idea that it's that hard to get a warrant. He said, you know, I've been out on a Sunday afternoon. They come find me. They, you know, they show me the paperwork. I sign it on the back of my motorcycle. And so you can get a warrant if you need to get a warrant. It's not like this horrible challenge.
And law enforcement is supposed to be difficult in a free society. It's easy in a communist society. They just put you against the wall and shoot you. You know, hopefully we've gotten to a much higher standard here in a free society. All right, let's get back to the court case. It says, the third clause. I skipped the first two. The mask mandate is more closely related to a power discussed in subsection B. This is section 264 of this Public Health Services Act. They're actually taking from subsection B, conditional release. I want to talk about this term because this term is really important too. Conditional release. The mandate requires a traveler to do something to have the privilege of passing a checkpoint and continuing on his journey. In other words, a person may travel subject to or dependent on a condition, namely that he wear a mask. Black's Law Dictionary defining conditional, defining release to include the fact of being freed from restraint or confinement. Webster's Third International Dictionary defined confine as to prevent free outward passage or motion of. That power is not contemplated in subsection A, the one that the CDC says they're relying on to enforce their mask mandate. It says it's contemplated in subsection B, which provides for the apprehension, detention, or conditional release of individuals, defining conditional release as temporary supervision and monitoring. See also 40. It says, or conditional release order may travel if the CDC approves of the precautions taken to prevent the potential transmission or spread of a communicable disease. So potential transmission, conditional release. You know, you have no liberty to travel. You have no freedom of movement unless you comply with this, and they can't even prove that you're sick. They're just applying it to everybody, and it becomes a privilege. So you don't have a right to travel anymore. Traveling becomes a privilege conditional upon your complying with what we think is an arbitrary and capricious illegal mandate. Jonathan.
I thought that was a very interesting analysis that I've never heard before because, you know, in my words, what Judge Menzel is saying is that if you're wearing a mask, you can stand over there.
Right.
If you're not wearing a mask, you have to stand over there. In fact, segregating people into two places is essentially a quarantine or temporary detention. So saying, you know, if you have to stay out there if you're not wearing a mask.
Right.
So that constitutes quarantining someone based upon whether they wear a mask or not.
Bianchi?
Yeah, and that's been going on in restaurants. But get this, the people with the masks on are the ones that's being quarantined, not the ones without the masks.
How's that? Explain it. I think you're onto something.
Well, look at them. There's something wrong with them. They got old masks.
Yeah, I think it's a quarantine I think it's a mental quarantine rather than a physical one, even though it's physically displayed. We'll talk about that in another show, too. The judge says here, the power to conditionally release a person. In other words, you're actually arrested. You know, you are restrained. You are confined before you comply with this procedure. And it says the power to conditionally release a person bears similarity to a provisional pratique. And this is a brand new word to me, P-R-A-T-I-Q-U-E, which allowed a vessel to enter the port only after completing some narrow and discrete task, typically fumigation of cargo or the like. And this is Becerra again. Indeed, the mandate likens itself to pratique, saying that conveyance operators operating a conveyance arriving at or departing from a U.S. port of entry must require all persons on board to wear masks for the duration of travel as a condition-controlled free pratique. Have you ever heard of pratique before? It's very interesting.
No.
That's new to me.
Okay. It says a conditional release does the same for individuals. Both measures grant clearance to travel when a person or object conforms to the procedures required by public health officials. The opposite of conditional release is detention or quarantine. Anyone who refuses to comply with the condition of mask wearing is, in a sense, detained or partially quarantined by exclusion from a conveyance or transportation hub under authority of the mask mandate. They are forcibly removed from their airplane seats, denied boarding at the bus steps, and turned away at the train station doors, all on the suspicion that they will spread a disease. In other words, you're guilty until proven innocent. Prior restraint, you're being arrested for something that we think you have the potential to do. Without any proof of it. Back to the case. Indeed, the judge says the mask mandate enlists, here we go again, local governments, airport employees, flight attendants, and even ride-sharing drivers to enforce these removal measures. In short, their freedom of movement is curtailed in a way similar to detention and quarantine. Jonathan.
Yeah, and that's assumption that Yucky. Something's wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're assuming that something is wrong with you, so you have to wear a mask.
Right. And how do they assume that? Go ahead. I'll tell you how they assume that. We mentioned it before.
Well, they have no way to assume that.
No. Asymptomatic transfer. In other words, people who have no symptoms of a disease can pass it on anyway. That's the whole basis. The mask mandate is really based on this mythical concept of asymptomatic transfer, that everybody's infected, everybody's sick, everybody's a carrier. You know, you have to wear a mask to protect other people from you, because even though you have absolutely no symptoms, you could easily be a COVID character. So there's the fallacy. So they're using a fake medical thing of asymptomatic transfer, you know, to justify an illegal mask mandate. So you got lies on top of lies on top of lies in order to bring this about, and they're not using public comment. They're not going through administrative procedures. So in other words, they're not only are they creating lies throughout this entire thing for the mask mandate, they're avoiding the government procedures, which would take into account their lies and rule it illegal before the mask mandate ever took place. That's the problem for me. Bianchi, Jonathan?
I agree.
You presume sick unless, well, you presume sick always.
You always presume sick. No matter what. Even if you're healthy, you're sick, right? That's what they say. Even if you're healthy, asymptomatic transfer means you're sick, or you could be a carrier, I think. And the judge never talked about that, but I think that's critical to understanding this case. Anyway, the judge says, as a result, the mask mandate is best understood not as sanitation, but as an exercise of the CDC's power to conditionally release individuals to travel despite concerns that they may spread a communicable disease, and to detain or partially quarantine those who refuse. But the power to conditionally release and detain is ordinarily limited to individuals entering the United States from a foreign country. Subsection, there we go. So that's it. So this is where the CDC power, as I understood it, was if you have Ebola, you know, you have symptoms of Ebola, you're going to be held at the border. And who's going to do that? Not the CDC, but Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Immigration. They're going to hold you at the border. I've never seen a CDC people at an airport. Are they there? Or are they in Washington making guidelines?
Well, they could be called, but I think you're right. I mean, and this is where it's interesting, because in her choice, and she didn't maybe make this explicit, but in her choice of which dictionary definition to use, the fact that the regulation deals with travel is I think relevant. It doesn't mean, you know, they didn't say that you always have to wear a mask all the time, no matter where you are. They said specifically, like, when you travel, you have to wear a mask, which I think tips the balance towards the dictionary definition she chose. And also the statute specifically ties, as I think you said, but just to emphasize it, specifically ties the concept of quarantining people or separating them, that they're entering from a foreign country. So that tips the balance, too, in terms of what the CDC is allowed to do.
You know, it's interesting. The Supreme Court said that we do have a right to travel. I remember this case in California where they said you couldn't get welfare unless you'd been in – this is back when California was a decent state. You couldn't get welfare unless you'd been in the state 6 months and had actually worked, you know, paid something into the tax base. And the Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional. You can't stop people from coming to California and signing up for welfare, because that violates their right to travel. Well, if we have a right to travel, how come the Supreme Court never took that issue up in terms of this mask mandate? That makes no sense. Who wants that issue?
I guess after this, they may although it's going to be a while because the judge myself sent it back to the CDC
right.
for the proceedings, which Uh-oh. Means this could go on
yeah.
for quite a while before it gets to the Supreme Court. But, you know, I imagine they will have to take it up.
Looks like I got a new caller here. Although it might be one of our reporters, I'm not sure. I don't have it listed on my master list. So let's try an experiment here. Actually, the number looks kind of familiar. So let me make this line live. If you hear the word unmute, that's you. And let's see who we've got on the line. Welcome to Action Radio. Who have I got?
Hey, Greg, it's Derek. It's Derek.
Oh, okay. There, I see. You're on my other list. You're on my financial list. Yeah. We're talking about a little different thing here today, but you're welcome to join our discussion. Have you been listening so far at all or no?
No, I just piped in. You know, I told you I'd try to call you when I was in between
right.
appointments. Sorry.
Yep. No, that's okay. No, and I forgot too. So what we're doing today, because Cindy couldn't make it today, we're going over the entire case of Judge Mizell's decision to overturn the mask mandate. So I apologize. I hope I didn't drag you in under false pretenses here. If you have a comment on that, that's fine. But I think what we might do, and especially if Jonathan's available tomorrow during 8:30 Eastern, 7:30 Central, Derek's time, if you want to talk about the Elon Musk situation with Twitter again.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be on tomorrow, so no worries. You know, happy to be a part of the discussion this morning while I'm en route.
Okay. Well, this
one's
in.
I caught the last half about you know, they're in an uphill battle, you know, going to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this has been – we've been doing this court case the entire show. We got about 40 minutes left. It's really kind of interesting. I think you'll find – you got to be a real, you know, legal nerd to really get into this. So, Jonathan, if you're available tomorrow, you want to call in during Derek's report, we can get on to the Elon Musk situation, which I know you want to talk about also. All right, so back to the case here. As a result, the mask mandate –
You know,
is
by the point that –
Go ahead. Bianchi, go ahead. Yeah.
To the point that he made about going to the Supreme Court. The problem lies is when the people don't take care of these matters at state level like they should be done.
Well, that's a huge point, too. Jonathan, you want to address that? I sort of got lost in my place here while I move things around.
Well, I mean, he's right. I mean, what can I say is that, and I think the Federalist Papers describe that a lot, as we've talked about, is that, you know, sometimes when some fears of overreach in their federal government raised, the writers of the Constitution said, oh, that will never happen. The people won't allow it.
Yeah.
And we have allowed it. We haven't done anything.
Well, that's why I created Action Radio. You just defined it right there. Let me get back to the court case. I think I found my place. It says neither detention nor quarantine are contemplated in Section 264. And for Derek, this is this Public Health Services Act from 1944, which is what the CDC relied on for the mask mandate. It says the sections the CDC relied upon to issue the mask mandate, instead of Section A, they actually relied on Sections B through D. It says, as a result, the mask mandate is best understood not as sanitation, but as an exercise of the CDC's power to conditionally release individuals to travel, despite concerns that they may spread a communicable disease, and to detain or partially quarantine those who refuse. I think I already covered that. All right, I'm a little bit lost here. Let me see if I covered that. Oh, here we go. The government disagrees, asserting that subsection A gives it the power to regulate persons traveling in interstate commerce. This is the thing Jonathan mentioned earlier, so I want to cover that again. For the reasons explained above, the court is not persuaded. Subsection A refers to direct impositions on property, while subsections B through D contemplate direct restrictions on individual movement, as discussed above. Section B through D give the CDC power to directly regulate individuals only. And here's the big part. Regulate individuals only if they are traveling into the United States from abroad or are reasonably believed to be infected with a communicable disease in a qualifying stage. The CDC mask mandate extends to city bus terminals and ride-sharing services, not just to individuals coming into a state or possession of a foreign country, and it applies to all persons in an airport without any findings that any individual reasonably believed is to be infected with COVID-19. So my point here is that, a question for Jonathan, if the CDC focuses on Section A of a law and what they're actually doing comes from Sections B through D, in other words, another section, does that have a bearing on their case? In other words, they could be flawed for focusing on the wrong section of law, or does the court say, well, you should have meant this section. This is where you're actually you know, what you're actually talking about is in this section. How does that come out in court cases?
Well, it weakens their argument. The problem
okay.
is that, again, appeals courts try to find any excuse not to do anything. Mm-hmm. And this is what I was going to say about this going up on the Supreme Court from the,
okay.
I think Derek's comment, is that the appeals courts will say that, well, they got it wrong, but they could have reached the same decision for a different reason, which is not, you know, the reason why we have appeals courts is to correct errors, not to, you know, not so the appeals courts can go golfing later that day. but they have a million excuses for
right.
not doing, for like, no, we're not going to take this appeal because, you know, we made up, because it's a Thursday and, you know, and we don't take appeals on Thursdays or something. They may use that to say, well, you got it totally wrong, but we're going to fix it for you. And you know, which is...
Well, this judge is saying just the opposite. So, you got it totally wrong, and we're going to overrule you. You don't have the authority to issue a mask mandate based on a provision of a 1944 law that doesn't apply because you made up a bunch of stuff on sanitation, and you made up a justification. You cited the wrong section of law, and you guys are overruled. I mean, that's what she's saying, right?
Right. And, I mean, what courts should do more often is saying, hey, we're going to send it back to you to do your homework over again.
Okay.
They could deal with that by saying, like, look, you did it wrong, but we're going to send it back to you, and if you can fix it, you know, try again. Which is what they could do and should do. But anyway, and the same thing with the Supreme Court, of course. This.
Oh, you're fading out again. Come on back. There we go. Okay, now you're back.
They're saying, I mean, this Supreme Court, supposedly conservative, has shown they're really not interested in doing anything.
Right.
Or not anything consequential. You know, there's a lot of things we've talked about that at the Supreme Court matter all that much to the country. But, you know, they matter to some trade association or something like that. But the Supreme Court tends to duck anything really important. But Kavanaugh supposedly was championed as this guy, a champion of the unitary executive, which is a way of saying that the president is the head of the executive branch. So he was supposedly this crusader against everything we're talking about departments, you know, government agencies being able to make laws and do things on their own to be accountable to nobody.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the Federal Society wanted him, and that's why the left hated him. But he's shown absolutely no sign of life on the topic that is supposedly his biggest. I mean, they probably could put his photograph on the back of a milk carton in terms of what was supposed to be his big cause to live.
You know, it's fascinating that the Three Stooges, you know, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch, took positions that really could have been filled by people of the caliber of Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas. We could have had real conservatives. I would have put this judge, Judge Mazzell, on the court. And though she's 35, I don't care. I know she's a Trump appointee. I especially don't care about that. I think that's wonderful. But you've got someone here who has the perfect legal analysis that, Derek, you know, like I say, if you have a chance sometime to go back, you know, 2.5 hours where we started this debate and discussion of this court case, it's fascinating. I mean, she really goes over this in ways that I know Judge Jackson is going to govern strictly by ideology, you know, as opposed to this person. We even put the things that she ultimately rules against, she put the counter arguments in just to show, you know, how she arrived at her conclusions. All right, let's get to, we've got about half an hour left, and we may pick this up next week. I'll go to Jonathan to see what he wants to do too. The Chevron deference. It says, finally, the government invokes Chevron deference, arguing that even if its reading of Section 264A is not the best one, the court should adopt it anyway. Chevron deference requires that courts defer to an agency interpretation of a statute that the agency administers when the statute is ambiguous and the interpretation is reasonable. Well, that seems a contradiction of itself. If the statute is ambiguous, the interpretation is, you know, can't be reasonable. The thing is to fix the statute so it's not ambiguous. Anyway, this is Chevron USA
against
National Resources Defense Council. Yeah, go ahead. Jump right in. Yeah, go ahead.
so this is finally Jaws comes out of the, you know, and starts to eat you. This is the monster that I've been hinting at all this time.
Yep.
Is that not only do nameless, fameless, faceless bureaucrats make up laws that Congress doesn't want to take responsibility for, mm-hmm. and there's nothing you can do about it, but to make mm-hmm. it, and again, do appeals courts try to dodge issues when people clearly get it wrong, but to make it even worse, the Supreme Court decided in 1984, ironically,
well, that's interesting.
Chevron USA versus National Resources Defense Council, which says that if, you know, when a government agency interprets something,
right.
that the courts are required to give deference to these nameless, faceless bureaucrats. So instead of looking at it afresh and saying, well, this is objectively wrong,
right.
We're just gonna assume that the government agency is right, and again, this comes in. Remember, the Nazis, the Soviets, everybody like that. They all pretended that they were scientific.
Right.
You know, not Nazism.
So they followed
was
the science.
Pure science.
the Aryan, you know, racism was following the science. is that how they justified it?
And communism. Communism sold itself as very scientific and everything. And this all comes in the same age of the 30s, the 1930s. And, you know, this myth that we would have these apolitical experts hired mm-hmm. by the government who would be immunized from political, forces or, you know, unaccountable to the
fascist.
Public because they could just – exactly. They could follow the – your pure expertise. So the theory is that the government agency is making the decisions based upon its expertise in its subject matter. Yeah. And so the courts are going to defer to their interpretation of the statute or a regulation or a fact or something like that. And so what they're asserting is that even if, you know, is it the CDC should be the arbiter of
mm-hmm.
what that public health law means, because they are experts in applying that law. Where was that? The original, the Public Health Services Act of 1944, PHSA, 42 USC, 264A, to say, well, we deal with this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got expertise in this, so you should listen to us, what we think the law says. What it means.
This is staggering because you look at all the things where they went wrong. They completely lied about COVID. They fudged the books. They changed the statistics. They pushed a vaccine snake oil DNA changing jab and completely discounted cures, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. Every step along the way, they've screwed up. They've pushed their patentable medicine so they can make billions of dollars in profits. They've wrestled over the patents in Moderna and the National Institute of Health were in court wrestling over who gets the money. They're like siblings at an estate hearing, you know, at a will. You know, I mean, it's fascinating what they're doing every step along the way. And then the court says after the misinterpretation, the misuse of the Public Health Services Act, you know, the lies, the mandates, everything, the lack of public participation, the lack of a comment, the publishing in the Federal Register saying, okay, that's it, we're done. And then coming along and saying, well, Chevron deference requires that courts defer to an agency interpretation of a statute that the agency administers when the statute is ambiguous and the interpretation is reasonable. Well, first of all, how do you judge that? And secondly, why would you put all the power in an agency? The whole point of checks and balances is that other branches of government, you know, check and balance any particular branch of government. So this actually defies separation of powers as well as everything else. That's my rant.
Yeah.
Jonathan?
Accountability. I mean, again, unless you believe that the purpose of our government is to allow politicians to get reelected without actually, you know, being accountable for anything and make as much money as possible and try to avoid criticism. It's like Mitch McConnell and his, I mean, of all the things that Mitch McConnell is, the worst thing is he's a con artist, because he's one of those people who always said that, you know, oh, you know, because they could have ended, say, Obamacare during the lame duck session.
Mm-hmm.
After they lost. But no, he always wants to say, oh, next time you have to vote for us. We'll hold this, you know, this sword of Damocles over your head, because, you know, in the next election, you have to vote for us. And that's why right now, like, Rick Scott is trying to propose changes, you know, like a contract with America. Mm-hmm. And Mitch McConnell is opposing it because he doesn't want to actually do anything. He just wants to constantly scam people into voting for his thing. So anyway, so the whole point of politicians is to say things like, oh, you know, this is terrible and there's nothing we can do about it. You know, it's like, you know, these people, you know, those damn bureaucrats, while they're, you know, behind the scene, they're strengthening that, you know, they're enabling these bureaucrats to do all these things. Yeah. But then they're pretending that, you know, oh yeah, it's too bad, but there's, you know, just nothing we can do about it.
Hmm.
That's the problem there is that Chevron, the thing is that, now the question is, so they're saying that even if the judge has the correct decision, you shouldn't listen to her because the Chevron requires deference to the agency.
Well, but the condition is the interpretation has to be reasonable. And I think the interpretation is completely unreasonable. You know, and we lost Eric, but we'll get him back tomorrow if you want to call in during his report. We'll talk about that off the air. But, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me go on because the judge actually contradicts and does not go by the Chevron deference. She says, but a court defers only if a statute is ambiguous after the court – ambiguous, and here we go – after the court uses all the traditional tools of statutory construction. We've got here General Dynamics, Land Systems, et cetera, explains deference to an agency's statutory interpretation is called for only when the devices of judicial construction have been tried and found to yield no clear sense of congressional intent. A court may not rest on Chevron to avoid rigorous statutory analysis. Sound good? All right, let me read the rest of it while Jonathan's unmuting. It says a court cannot wave the ambiguity flag just because it found the statute impenetrable on first read. As explained above, the statute is not ambiguous. Congress addressed whether the CDC may enact preventive measures that condition the interstate travel of an entire population on adherence to CDC dictates. It may not. So that is the end of the matter. There we go. Sounds pretty straightforward to me, Jonathan.
Yeah, well, she's correct. It's just that again, these things are observed they're observed by ignoring them, and it is a rule that Chevron means. Chevron has been held to mean that you don't that an agency cannot be the arbiter of its own jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the question is whether it has power to do something, Chevron does not apply. But yeah, these words are thrown around, and they're, you know, they're honored in the breach, not in the observance.
The same way the Supreme Court cannot make up their own powers, like judicial review. You know, this idea that the government can do something, and even if the government does something they think is reasonable, that doesn't give them the right to do something, even if it is reasonable, if it doesn't follow procedure. Because if you can do something reasonable without proper procedure, you can do something unreasonable without proper procedure.
Yeah. Yeah, but so you know, a lot is hidden behind Chevron, even though she is correct, Judge Mizell is correct, and the agency cannot grant itself power or mm-hmm. grant itself jurisdiction by its own interpretation of what it thinks its enabling act says. It's for other things, like it's for interpreting things that are not about its own power to do something. But, you know, few people understand that or follow that.
Yeah. There's another section here. It says, but there's an independent bar to the government's invocation of Chevron, the major questions doctrine. I'm not sure what that is. I've never heard of it. It says the government's interpretation is untenable because courts expect Congress to speak clearly if it assigns decisions of vast economic and political significance to an administrative agency. The CDC asserts that such a power is in the mask mandate, but 264A is far from such a grant. So what's this? Have you heard this before, the major questions doctrine?
I haven't heard it that terms, but I mean, again, it's a rule of interpretation, which is that, you know, if you can interpret a statute as maybe having a small variance from the words, that may be reasonable. But if it's a gigantic leap from the words that Congress used, then it's extremely unlikely, if not prohibited. And that's what she's arguing, is that you can't make a huge leap from the wording of the statute to what the Biden administration. I mean, because they're selling it as being a huge thing, of huge consequence. So then Congress wouldn't have just slipped that in the, you know, in between the lines.
Mm-hmm. She's got a huge amount of evidence here. And Pianki, if you want to jump in, feel free. But she built a really strong case. And I know this is tedious and this may not be our most popular show, but I think it's one of our most valuable to be able to go over these issues and show the extent to which, you know, a decent judge will review all possible reasons, rationales, and logic, and actually make a decision, which is what they're supposed to do in this case. She's not making up new law. She's not instituting a policy. She's not creating rights out of the Constitution. She's not interpreting the Constitution, giving it new meaning. She's doing what a judge is supposed to do. So this is a proper use of the judiciary as opposed to judicial review, where they sort of make stuff up and they go beyond review, and you come up with things like Roe v. Wade. Which is fascinating. So let me get to another part here. The mask mandate improperly invoked the good cause exemption to the notice and comment rulemaking. This is what we talked about before. So back to the Administrative Procedures Act, requires that agencies provide an opportunity for the public to review and comment upon a new rule before it becomes legally binding. The logic being that the public says, hey, you guys are screwed up, you know, that the agency has to take that into account. In fact, if this actually had gone to public comment, I think the public comment would have overwhelmingly been, you know, stop it. Don't do this. But they didn't do that because they didn't want that opposition. Then she says the agency must publish a notice in the Federal Register that includes reference to the legal authority under which the rule is proposed. And we never got that. We just got the mandate, right? And either the terms or substance of the proposed rule or a description of the subjects and issues involved. And that's another section 553, whatever there are. Following publication, the agency must, that's a big word there, must give interested persons an opportunity to participate in the rulemaking through submission of written data, views, or arguments. This comment period must be at least 30 days, which is why I put that into my budget act, right? Finally, the agency must consider and respond to significant comments received during the period for public comment. That's Perez versus Mortgage Bankers. None of that was done. Jonathan, none of that was done. Why wasn't it suspended immediately? Because none of that was done. That's grounds for stopping the mask mandate day one, isn't it?
Well, it is. And, you know, the whole downside here is that this lawsuit was filed, I think, last July. It's taken this long, unfortunately. But again, they declared they didn't have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they tried to invoke an exception saying that it's not a law, it's not a regulation, which is just lying. And that there was an exception because it would, you know, it's like an emergency. And again, I started out by saying that they waited a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like saying we can't wait, even though this is a year after, a year and 1 month after COVID first broke out. So
yes, yeah,
so how is
a year
it
after,
such
you know,
an emergency that we? And
go ahead.
And by then also we had vaccines too by the time. So they're saying that, you know, it's such an emergency, we don't have to follow the Administrative Procedures Act a year after it. And COVID was winding down and we had other measures and everything
well,
like that. So it's just.
That's a really good point, because the whole thing of vaccines was they said the rule was take the vaccine and the mask isn't necessary. So they used the mask mandate. You know, but it was a mask guideline before, and of course the governors imposed it in a lot of states, and the school districts imposed it for all the kids, which is very unfortunate. But it wasn't a mandate at that point from the federal government, because, you know, most states and local areas were doing it anyway. It only became a mandate, as you say, after vaccines, and the whole point of the vaccine was that it was going to get us back to normal, that you didn't have to wear a mask if you were vaccinated. Then they said you did. So they mandated something that had already been precluded by something else that they mandated, the vaccine. This is fascinating.
And the reason all that wasn't done is because the urgency was the election.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Once they won the election illegally, they didn't care. All right. Let me get to another section here. The mask mandate improperly invoked the order and interpretive rule exceptions to notice and comment. The APA, Administrative Procedures Act, notice and comment procedures apply only to agency rulemaking, C5 USC 553B, which is the process of making a rule, quote, of general or particular applicability and future effect. It does not apply to case-by-case adjudication, which results in an order. So this is very interesting, all right? It says we've got a judge here explaining the distinction between rules and orders, nor does it apply to an agency's interpretive rules or general statements of policy, neither of which are binding on the public. This is the longstanding recognition that interpretive rules do not have the force and effect of law. But they're saying this does because it's a mandate. So what's going on here? Notice and comment does not apply to an agency rulemaking because this isn't a rule. What is a mandate if it's not a rule? I'm confused, Jonathan. Help me out here.
Well,
dog bark.
Completely offensive. Like I say, there are things that an government agency can do that are not a regulation or a rule, but they're more internal. It's like saying that, if you want to drop off a document, you can drop it off at the box at the security. Gate. It's a rule is something that affects people external to the agency. You know, like if an agency says, you know, employees will fill out their timesheets by Thursday, that would be completely internal to the agency. So I just think there's absolutely no possible justification for it, except they're just flagrantly lying, saying it's not a rule. I don't know what in the world they're talking about.
Yep. Yeah, I was quickly skimming through this. There's not a lot left here that we really haven't gone over. They get particulars, they get analysis, they get all kinds of other stuff. But I think the best thing to do at this point, because I think we've been through enough of this, is get right to the conclusion down here at the bottom and then just kind of talk generally about this for the remaining 13 minutes we have here. First of all, thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Pianchi. My apologies to one of our other callers. I'm not going to mention who just because. Who wanted to get on the line, but I really wanted to make sure we kept on point, on focus, and were able to do this properly here. All right, so let me see if I can find one other thing. Just looking real quickly here. We've got a couple of other sections. Whatever we got. This thing is so long and so detailed. It's like 50, I think it's 59 pages of stuff here. Let's see what we got here. She says, yeah, the mask mandate is vacated for violating the Administrative Procedures Act. As explained above, the mask mandate exceeds the CDC's statutory authority and violates the APA. Plaintiffs asked the court to declare it unlawful and set it aside. This remedy mirrors the relief they sought in their amended complaint. The government argues that plaintiffs' relief is limited to a declaratory judgment, and even if other relief is awarded, it should be limited to non-enforcement of the mask mandate. Yeah, so I guess they want their mask mandate, but they don't want it enforced, so they're kind of trying to have their cake and eat it too. Let me scroll all the way down here. All right, so here's the last little bit. Conclusion, Section 4. It is indisputable that the public has a strong interest in combating the spread of COVID-19. In pursuant of that end, the CDC issued the mask mandate, but the mandate exceeded the CDC's statutory authority, improperly invoked the good cause exception to notice and comment rulemaking, and failed to adequately explain its decisions, because our system does not permit agencies to act unlawfully, even in pursuit of desirable ends, the court declares unlawful and vacates the mask mandate. Accordingly, the following is ordered. Plaintiff's motion for summary judgment is granted. On counts 1, 2, and 3, defendant's motion for summary judgment is denied. The court declares unlawful and vacates the mask mandate, remanding it to the CDC for further proceedings consistent with this order. Jonathan, to sum it all up, what happened? I can read it again, any part of it.
Well, the judge Michelle actually followed the law, which is, refreshing. But I say the difficult, I'm not sure that she describes it as to why she's sending it back to the CDC. I think that
why wouldn't you just overturn it and just suspend it, injunction? Like the mask, the vaccine thing was just stopped. I mean, they didn't, right?
I don't know that. I mean, that part is not clear. So the question being, of course, not just academic, but what happens next.
Right.
I mean, she vacated the mask mandate. Clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, normally with these cases, there's not. Well, I mean, no, she granted summary judgment. I don't know why. I mean, the case could have ended here. I don't know why Judge Mizell is sending it back to the CDC so they can fudge it up.
What's she expecting them to do?
Somehow.
I mean, if I know the CDC, the first thing they're going to say is this decision is wrong. We're going to appeal it. We do have the authority. They're going to make all the arguments they just made, and they're going to say, well, we're going to, in the meantime, let's reimpose the mask mandate, you know, while this is in adjudication. I mean, that's what I expect them to do, although I don't think Brandon has a stomach for it. But that's the part that's confusing. If it's unlawful and it's vacated, why are you sending it back to the CDC? Who thinks it is lawful? That doesn't make sense.
The Department of Justice says they are going to appeal. And and again, these guys have no, you know, the Democrats just seem to, they just have no sense of how unpopular their positions are. And they're all, you know, they're all saying like, oh, we need to, you know, if we don't advance our agenda, we're going to get clobbered in the election. No, if you do advance your agenda, you're going to get clobbered in the election.
Yeah.
But, you know, so this is going to be really bad, you know, bad publicity for them, but they are going to do it. And you're right. An appeal court may very well, get, you know, put a stay on it and, which would be bad. So I don't know why. And I guess, I mean, the only thing I can think of is that by sending it back to the CDC could go through the, notice and comment process.
Do you think they're going to, given what people feel about it? I mean, people hate the mask mandate, except for the Karens.
Yeah.
You know, and the Todds.
Right.
You know, the metrosexuals and the Karens are the only people, you know, people that go for this have no sense of freedom, have no sense of America first, have no sense of anything because they want to, I mean, I don't care if they want to do it themselves. The people that want to put a mask on themselves aren't the problem. It's the people that want to put a mask on everybody. You know, that feel it's their civic duty, that that their job is to regulate everybody else's behavior. That's the problem. And the CDC gave those people the power and the excuse to do that. You know, they're all like, it's like if the world were run by homeowner association presidents. You know, this would be a terrible place. You couldn't do anything.
Oh, my God.
Right. This is the best example I can think of.
Pretty much.
Yeah, but when you think about the right to travel was not considered, the basic, just basic freedoms to your person. You know, in the Fourth Amendment, you know, there was no due process. Due process was violated because they didn't follow the Administrative Procedures Act.
Like,
go ahead.
Like I say, it is normal, and she doesn't. I don't think she explains why she's sending it back, and doesn't explain some of these things explicitly. But it is normal to say that if you have 10 reasons why the mask mandate should be struck down, and the court accepts one, it isn't necessary to go into the other 9. So if this one is overturned on appeal, it would naturally come next to, well, what about the other arguments? You know, so hopefully all those other things, the constitutional right. I mean, it is true that the constitutional right to travel has been upheld, and therefore they should have to prove that it's strictly, you know, it's narrowly tailored to advance a significant public interest. Or if it's strict scrutiny, that it's you know, that's strictly necessary to a compelling state interest, and of course they can't do that. But
this is
getting up and lying.
This is a huge issue that Jim Dykes and I get into big arguments about. And we're both on the same side of it, but he argues, you know, this idea that that rights can be violated, limited, restricted, that they can do these things if there's a compelling state interest. Well, there's always a compelling state interest for the state. They love to limit rights. They love to get rid of rights. They will use any power, any emergency, any excuse, any executive order, anything they can. In fact, it's this knee-jerk reaction. We talk about this in the Australian Bill of Rights, the knee-jerk reaction of government that no matter what the crisis, no matter what situation, condition, or whatever, the first thing they do is they want to limit rights. And limiting of rights has nothing to do with solving the problem. In fact, we proved conclusively in part of the presentation for our presentation of the Australian Bill of Individual Rights, is that the freedoms that were lost, the free access of information, the freedom of speech, the informed consent, those things actually made the pandemic last 2 years longer than it would have. This thing would have been cured in a few months. Mm-hmm. If everybody knew about ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, vitamin D, C, zinc, if they knew about the treatments, if they knew to get treatments early, this thing would have been done. You know, in fact, it was done pretty much by July. It probably would have been done sooner than that. And there would be no pandemic. There would be the real pandemic, as we talk about, the real pandemic here is the pandemic of government power. That's the pandemic. The virus is something completely separate, considering that 99.95% of people are not severely affected by it. Okay. And so this is where the real problem is. And the government is using this to take away rights. They couldn't take our rights away with climate change. Well, they're still doing that, you know, but this is like this is like climate change on steroids. And that the knee-jerk reaction, as Pianki is fond of saying, that the Constitution doesn't have an on and off switch. All right. Once the Constitution was ordained and established, that's it. You can amend it, but you can't shut it off or limit it. And I don't give a damn about this stupid argument about, well, we've got a compelling state interest. I don't care. Do whatever you want for the state as long as you don't touch our individual rights. And in fact, the enforcement of individual rights is actually the best solution. So the real compelling state interest is protecting our individual rights so that we can solve the crisis far faster than the government did, using their, quote, compelling state interest to put mandates on us and extend it even to this day. That's the problem. Freedom works. It does. Pianki, Jonathan? 4 minutes left.
Well, yeah, the issue is, of course, is that our Bill of Rights and things were written in such broad, unworkable terms that they kind of required some kind of balancing. Whereas if they had been written more precisely with a little bit more detail, we never would have gotten into that idea of making exceptions.
Well, let me give you a little preview of next week, because the Australian Bill of Individual Rights is going to be released. Pianki, do you have a quick comment? I'm going to give you the first three rights.
It was written that way because no one would have imagined two men wanting to marry.
Perfect example. All right. Without going into the explanations, because they're on the video, which will be out next week, probably the end of next week. Right number one, Australian Bill of Rights, written by Jen Clark and myself. All rights are individual. There are no group or collective rights. Right number two, all rights are absolute within the context of the right. Any infringement on any right, regardless of crisis or severity, declared public purpose or justification, condition or emergency, declaration of emergency powers, war or pandemic, natural disaster, or any other factor, including safety, which we put in later, real or imagined by government is prohibited. It's right number two. Right number three, these enumerated rights upon establishment of this Bill of Individual Rights are permanent rights of the people and are not subject to government suspension or revocation for any reason. Citizens have the right to a timely court challenge with a representative citizen jury. Let's go back again. I think I skipped it right there. Let me get back in. Slideshows. Citizens have the right to a timely court challenge with a representative citizen jury for any violations of these individual rights. Those are just the first three. Jonathan?
No, it's huge. It's a very interesting thing. I mean, if you think of Australia as being similar to the United States, and it's, in many ways, it's good to try to make those improvements. I think it's necessary. And like I say, I think that I think that the style of our Constitution being worded in very broad brushstrokes, which has invited some of the mischief that we've had. So I think that getting it better, getting it right is important.
Well, you see, I've taken out compelling state interests, and I've taken out the ability to restrict rights and the ability to turn off the Constitution. Well, I've tried to take into account all the things that our own government has used to suppress rights and put those into these first three rights so that people understand they're absolute within the context, they're permanent, and they are individual. There's no group rights. You know, you can't bring on those sideline things. Go ahead, Pianki.
Make sure you post those. And Jonathan, this has been longer than the OJ trial.
Yeah. We got a minute left. Let's use it fruitfully and productively. First of all, let me thank you both for being a part of this, and my apologies to the callers that I couldn't take, and to Derek too, because I did. We were going to talk about. I get confused sometimes as to all the things that we do, and you know, a lot of this is very spontaneous, and so I'm glad everybody sort of rolled with that. But next week we're going to have our Australian Bill of Rights, and I think you can find it fascinating. I'd love. There's my 1 minute warning. I'd love to get a panel. In fact, I'm going to talk to some folks. Maybe Larry Klayman can join us. Maybe Chris Ann Hall can join us. Maybe both of them can join us. Maybe some other constitutional folks. Jonathan, I'm hoping Jerome Bell, who's a huge supporter of our citizen legislation, who I was hoping might call in today too, who's running on three of our bills, you know, and is the first congressional candidate to do so. So he's making history. I mean, a lot of things are happening at Action Radio that are unbelievable and that are changing the way things have been done traditionally. And so this is going to be fascinating. So if you're talking to Larry, you know, please let him know. And I'll talk to Chris Ann Hall's folks and anybody else you think of constitutional weight that may want to get involved with this. And then we'll get Jonathan Turley and, you know, Alan Dershowitz. We'll get some others if we can. Conclusions. 10 seconds left. Who wants it? Bianchi, Jonathan? Going once, going twice. All right.
I was going to Bianchi, let's watch tomorrow as they try to deplatform Marjorie Greene for participating in an election.
Is that going to be televised?
I don't know. It's probably it's going to be in Florida. No, it's going to be in Georgia, and it's going to be a court hearing where she's going to testify. So if I had the time, I'd attempt to fly down there, but I can't do that.
Well, let's see if we can do it. We're off the air, guys. Bianchi, go ahead, Bianchi.
Trying to impeach Clarence Thomas, now trying to do away with Marjorie Greene. They're pulling out all the threads.
It's racist voter suppression is what it is. We'll talk about that later. All right, guys, got to go. Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Our legislative website is writeyourlaws.com, WRITEYOURLAWS. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 7 Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, 4 Pacific. And the rest of you folks around the world, you guys will figure it out.